Thanks for listening to WRIF Online. The live web stream will begin in 15 seconds.
This is Matt Demmer of Jack Demmer Lincoln Mercury here to tell you about the exciting new Lincoln Mercury lineup. With the all-new Lincoln MKX, available all-wheel drive MKZ, or the newly designed Lincoln Navigator or Mercury Mariner, we have something for everyone. Stop in and see today. Jack Demmer Lincoln Mercury on Michigan Avenue in Dearborn.
Welcome to the award-winning Night Call, the Riff's phone-in talk show on 101 WRIF Detroit. Our number, 313-298-WRIF. Now, here's the host of Night Call, Peter Werby.
Well, thank you very much, and welcome to the broadcast. Joining me, of course, Jalene Jordan. Hi, Jalene.
Hi, Peter.
Make
sure that I'm not louder than you this week.
You're not. Why is Jeremy in here taking photographs of us?
Because I have demanded a photo shoot because we need some new photos on our MySpace. It's stale.
I don't know.
Yeah. Well, you know what?
What?
Sometimes, as a producer of the show, you just have to let me do a couple things.
I'm sort of having a bad hair day, though.
Yeah, but you have headphones on, so it doesn't matter.
You're right.
It's headphone hair.
Because how would you describe your hair?
I would describe it in...
Two pigtails?
Eclectic pigtails,
yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Because usually, like, when you go out on a gig or something like that,
yeah,
it's done up.
Oh, yeah. It's very, very rock and roll.
Yeah. So now yeah. You just don't care, or?
Well, no, it's.
Or you got headphones up.
It's a headphone thing.
Wow.
Yeah. I care. I always care.
That's what I thought. Well, so do I. Look at me. Hey, this is the Night Call Show. Peter Werby and Jalene Jordan. 313-298-WRIF and 313-298-9743. And you got more tattoos this week?
Five
tattoos.
Yeah, I mean, they're all small. They're kanji, and they're symbols with different meanings that are personal to me, you know.
Don't you think, though, that having M13 on your forehead is going to kind of interfere with your job possibilities?
Oh, come on. It's down my spine.
Down my spine.
Yeah. Yeah, and one of them was peace, which
that's
you'll
good.
Be happy to hear.
Yeah. These are Japanese characters.
Right, Japanese characters. And one is rise, which is about rising up, mm-hmm. you know, and then also speech. And my personal meaning is a couple, you know, twofold. One, that I speak a lot for the job that I do here at Riff, and also freedom of speech.
Sure. One thing that I always worry about when... Because I have more Chinese characters just because of doing Tai Chi and all this. And I always wonder, though, what if they're really not putting the character on?
That it is? I'm just going to believe
it.
But Royal Oak Tattoo, go see Ed on Washington and Royal Oak. He's the greatest.
Well, I saw, actually, you have photographs of them.
I do, in my pictures. Yes.
Yes, on your MySpace page.
Yeah, I do. I'm having slideshow issues, so if you want to see the pics, then you have to go to actual pictures. You could do that. And sometimes you have to be my friend, so sign on up.
Yeah, you can also go to the Night Call MySpace page by... See, I'm actually... This is... Never mind. You know, I'm not going to complain.
Okay.
I can handle a few photographs being taken of me. Anyway, you can go to peterwerby.com, P-E-T-E-R-W-E-R-B-E, and you can access my webpage and also the Night Call MySpace page and Jalene's MySpace page as
so
well.
So much to look at.
Well, you want the final nail in George Bush's political coffin?
Wait a minute. That happened about, years ago, right?
Yeah, 2000. In thinking people's minds. But it took, the rest, it took some time
for the world to catch up.
Yeah. How about this? This is from the Sunday Telegraph, this well-known United... Oh, no, it's actually in England, isn't it? How come we have to go to British papers to find out stuff?
We know why.
Yeah. Country music deserts George Bush. Country music has thrived for years as the soundtrack to redneck America, supplying the Republican heartlands with a diet of knee-jerk jingoism. Okay. You all know what jingoism is, right? Yeah. That has included flag-waving anthems supporting the war on terror. But as the U.S. death toll rises in Iraq and public patience with the conflict and with George W. Bush diminishes, many anti-war songs are emerging from Nashville. home of the genre.
Wow.
No one has moved further, and they're leaving out the word left, but it should be in here. I'm putting it in. It doesn't say here in this account. No one has moved further left than Toby Keith and Daryl Worley, two of the biggest names in country music.
Wait, Toby Keith has moved to the left?
Yeah, remember that, what's her name, Maines?
Natalie Maines.
Natalie Maines. So, you know, my brain isn't working. With the Dixie Chicks.
Yes. Yeah.
And so she used to wear on her shorts during her performances, it used to say F-U-T-K, which meant Toby Keith.
Yeah.
And but now, in 2002, Keith had a huge hit with Courtesy the Red, White, and Blue, which includes the lyric, "You'll be sorry that you mess with the U.S. of A. because we'll put a boot in your ass. It's the American way."
Yeah, I have not been able to stand the guy for years.
Worley's Have You Forgotten, in 2003, justified the Iraq invasion as a response to September 11th attacks. What a dope.
Yeah.
The military liked it so much he was presented with a flag that had flown over the Pentagon. Now Keith says he's a lifelong Democrat and has claimed he never supported the war, while Worley has a hit with I Just Came Back from a War about a soldier returning from Iraq with post-traumatic stress disorder. I mean,
change around. Yeah. Well, I'm glad.
Yeah. Tim McGraw, the biggest contemporary country star, has a hit single with If You're Reading This about a dead soldier's last letter home. And the Dixie Chicks boycotted in 2003 after lead singer Natalie Maines sold an audience in London. We're ashamed that the President of the United States is from Texas, won 5 Grammy Awards this year. The changing tone reflects a growing skepticism in the heartlands that have disproportionately contributed to young soldiers who have been fighting and dying. Brian Hyatt, associate editor of Rolling Stone magazine, said popular music is reflecting the culture as it always does. So,
well, it's about time.
Yeah, so warmongers and conservatives, right-wingers, please raise the white flag because you have lost. Now, you've lost politically, you have lost the culture war, but what is so tragic is this horrible war. The dying of American Iraqi people, the looting of our treasury, which I want to get to in a little while, continues apace. I mean, they talk about these interviews with Bush, and he just says, they say, never seen anybody so filled with self-confidence.
Yeah.
Why? Talk about being divorced from reality.
Right. Absolutely.
Let me see if there's anything more. Keith's switch, however, has angered conservative country fans and anti-war activists alike. John Iwanski, a blogger in Chicago, said Keith had damaged his credibility while opponents of the war accused the singer of opportunism. I don't.
No.
Well, but on the other hand,
we'd like to believe that he believes.
If it's opportunistic, hey, okay, seize the opportunity.
At least it's the right message.
Right. I see what he's saying. They're saying that, that he just blowing in the wind, blowing with the wind, right?
Yeah.
Well, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, the president of Iran, has arrived in the United States. Lots of protests. The president's motorcade, this is Ahmadinejad, not Bush, pulled up to a Midtown hotel where he was staying while he appears at a series of events, including the United Nations General Assembly and a forum at Columbia University, where about 40 elected officials and civic leaders decried his event. They were saying, a little Hitler. I mean, how can they... Well, you know, there's this whole deal now that people like Ahmadinejad in Iran have arisen as the great enemy of the United States. Well, why is Iran the enemy of the United States? Well, of course, because Iran is over here messing in Mexico, trying to establish hegemony.
Wait, no.
Oh, no, no.
No, no, no.
Okay. That's right.
Right.
Oh, yeah. It's the United States that's fighting two wars on the borders of Iran, one in Afghanistan on its eastern border and one in Iraq on its western border. And increasingly, you know, half the Navy striking force is within striking distance of Iran.
Ooh.
Yeah, yeah. He keeps saying he being Ahmadinejad, says there's not going to be a war. Although,
there was something that he spoke of about retaliation against Israel.
Yeah, he said if they attack, and it also came out that Cheney was urging Israel to attack Iran, and that would provoke Iran to attack Israel, and then that would be the justification for the United States. This guy is so evil. How is he still the vice president of the United States? I don't get it. At a parade in Tehran, a day ago or so, at the parade, Ahmadinejad repeated his demand for foreign forces to leave the region. Hey, what Is that not a bad idea? Get all the foreign forces out of the Middle East. That includes the United States, first and foremost, but all the rest of the coalition of the billing, right? All the ones that we were paying the freight for. And urge the United States to acknowledge it has failed in Iraq. Outside the 160,000 U.S. troops in Iraq, there are 40,000 troops on U.S. bases in Persian Gulf countries and another 20,000 in Mideast waters. Don't you think that would make any country a little nervous? I mean,
just a little.
These are pretty awful guys. I mean, I don't know why conservatives don't like them. They're these far right wing religious nuts.
Yeah, right. Right in line. Right in line with a lot of
conservatives. So I don't understand that. And the U.S. is accusing Iran of sending missiles to Iraq as well. But it says that if Israel attacks, it has all this modern weaponry. This is not any non-army like Saddam Hussein had, who had no army whatsoever. The United States knew it could attack initially and overwhelm the Iraqi army, which for all practical purposes didn't exist in 2003. Another one of the lies that Bush said and the rest of his mob. But I was listening to a right-wing talk show host coming in here. Now, well, you're looking at me, and what am I saying? I never listened to him. I always say I listened to him for 2 or 3 minutes.
Yeah, and that's about all.
That's all. They hurt my head. I mean, every word they say is a lie. Every single word they say is a lie. I think I've said this before, that they start off with a clause, and I go, well, that's not true. How in the world can they? And then they hit another clause, another sort of supporting clause. And they come to this conclusion, and I'm like screaming at the radio, and then they're on to the next sentence, which is filled with lies and mis and disinformation.
Right.
And there are people on the left that listen to these guys and these women, too, and they say, well, I see what the enemy's doing.
Yeah, why bother? We already know.
But this right winger, I don't even want to give his name.
And don't.
Yeah.
No free publicity for him.
Yeah, he said that the Iranian president, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, had arrived, and he said, I wonder if Nancy Pelosi was there to greet him, and I wonder if Cindy Sheehan was there to greet him. Now, this is...
What's his point?
Well, nothing. If this is this smear, this calumny, this insult, this, I mean, because both of these people, without even talking to them, I know, are completely critical of the Iranian regime under Ahmadinejad and the mullahs that run that suppress women. That run a religious conservative government that don't allow free speech and free press there. And yet, is this guy going to be admonished? Is the president of the United States going to say that he is disgusted by the fact that this right-wing talk show host insulted the Speaker of the House of Representatives of the United States of America?
Mm-hmm.
Maybe the Senate will pass a resolution 17-25 condemning this right-wing talk show host for this egregious insult on an elected public official.
Nah, they're too busy spending more money on the war.
Yeah.
What do you mean?
Well, of course, they did that with the MoveOn.org ad. I'm sorry, it was only 72 votes. Condemned MoveOn.org because of this ad in the New York Times that said General Petraeus or General Betrayus.
And Bush, this is the first time he has ever said anything about MoveOn.org. He's pretty much ignored them as a non-entity. But now he actually came out and said himself, I thought the ad was disgusting.
Disgusting.
I felt like the ad was an attack, not only on General Petraeus, but on the U.S. military, and I was disappointed that not more leaders in the Democrat Party spoke out strongly against that kind of ad.
Wait, did he say Democrat Party?
He did.
You know, that's language from the far right wing.
Yeah.
Now, I don't get that.
Yeah.
What is the deal between it being, they always say the Democrat Party.
They won't say Democratic, right.
Do they mean, is it like this slur because it's not really Democratic? Or what's their little point?
Well,
their little pointy heads are always...
pointy heads.
They are such a strange, weird group. How did they ever achieve such prominence in this country?
I don't know. He continues to say, that was a sorry deal. It's one thing to attack me. It's another thing to attack somebody like General Petraeus. It's like, what? What are you talking about there? The fact is, I love that MoveOn.org has finally gotten under his skin.
Yeah, and it was actually good for MoveOn.org. If you ever want to look at the, I don't know if they still have it up there, but you can go to MoveOn.org. That's also the name of the group and also the website. And they've taken in hundreds of thousands of dollars in donations since the ad appeared. And not since the ad appeared, but since the attack of the right wing that's trying to shift the debate, trying to shift the issue. Now, let's say, you know, I think you can gain a lot with these Nimrods by accepting a lot of their premises. All right, let's say that the ad was disgusting, the ad was inappropriate, the ad was wrong. I mean, even some liberals, little weak-kneed liberals, are saying that it went
a little too far.
Went a little too far and all that. Okay, so good, move on. .org.
No pun intended.
Yeah, because it's not about an ad in a newspaper. It's not about this right-wing guy saying, I wonder if Nancy Pelosi was there to greet Ahmadinejad. I couldn't care less whether he says that, to tell you the truth. And I certainly don't care that MoveOn.org criticized a politicized general that's carrying water for this lying far-right wing president that is responsible now for the deaths of a million Iraqis and thousands of Americans, almost 4,000 Americans, with 20, 30,000 horribly injured and disfigured and
maimed
and post-traumatic stressed Americans. So that's what's really at issue. That's what's really at issue here. If you got some issues, Peter Werby, Jelaine Jordan at 313-298-WRIF. And any thoughts about, I mean, I usually don't ask questions. You can comment on whatever you want as a listening audience and callers. But I don't know this article about the fact that now even the country music heavyweights have moved to the left and are critical of the war in Iraq and are critical of Bush. And it says at the end of this article that I read before, said Toby Keith and Daryl Worley said that the fact that now they're doing anti-war stuff and that Toby Keith has said he's been a lifelong Democrat, that it says at the end here, opponents of the war accuse the singer of opportunism. So what does that mean, opponents of the war? All opponents of the war? Well, 70% of Americans are. So all 70% of Americans are? Or who? Who are the people that they're referring to? See, this is bad journalism. This is
there's a lot of that going around out there.
Do you think?
Yeah.
And what else? Oh, yeah. All right. Here's eventually what I wanted to get to. And it's our so-called economy. The Michigan, again, is one of the nation's highest foreclosure rates. And, Jelaine, you've been looking for a house. So you saw how many, isn't that incredible how
many
houses?
Incredible. Empty houses everywhere.
Do you have any idea whether all the houses that are for sale in the area you were looking were ones that were product of foreclosure or?
No, not where I was looking.
Yeah.
More, kind of the outskirts of where I was looking. Yeah.
Yeah. Did, because I know the realtor, your friend Dan was, so did he say anything about that? Did he know whether that was all foreclosure stuff or?
No, I don't think any of what I looked at was, actually.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, that's good.
Yeah.
I guess it's just that people aren't buying, which as a buyer, it's a buyer's market,
it's
right?
A good thing.
Yeah.
Got a good deal.
Yeah. But the state of Michigan, the budget crisis continues. And you're probably thinking, oh, man, budget crisis, state budget crisis, Lansing. This is not going to be a very interesting segment of Night Call. Stay with me here, because what it's about is you and I getting further looted. Again, we live in the wealthiest country in the world, and there is about $1.5 billion shortfall between what the state of Michigan figures is going to take in. More than that, $1.75, almost $2 billion between income and expenses projected for the state government in the 12 months ahead. So the legislature is there. I don't want to go into all the details because that's not really the important part. The important part is why in this this nation that has hundreds of billions of dollars to spend on wars that nobody in this country wants, other than George Bush and a few whacked out conservatives, is the state of Michigan at a point where the state government may shut down unless they get some money in. Now, they have to, you know, there's a new fiscal year, as they call it, the beginning at the first of the next month, and they're required by our Constitution to have the Michigan State Constitution, to have a balanced budget. So they're talking about raising the income tax. And this doesn't sound much like from 3.9 to 4.3, But I can't even do the math on it. But with a flat tax, of course, the less you make, the more this hits you. I mean, and if you're not making a lot of money to begin with, $150 is big time to you. If you're making $200,000 and they say, hey, your tax rate just went up $400, you go, all right, here, man, I got it in my pocket.
Yeah.
Let me just reel it off.
Right.
But they're also talking about raising the sales tax 2%. So we're starting, if this is the point, we're talking about 6.3% of total taxes, which, of course, isn't the total taxes. This stuff is so, I'm trying to shorthand this and conflating this. But this is a system of looting, because if you think about this, I'm not trying to say the state is trying to loot. It has to do something. It is required to balance the budget. So it either has to get more money, eliminate expenditures, which would mostly be social programs, our universities and roads and everything like that, helping poor people, sick, our hospitals and what have you, or it has to charge us more money. So the real question is, why are we in this situation to begin with? And people say, it's the Republican. No, it's Jennifer Granholm, the Democrats.
I hear that all the time,
Well, if you're at the top, which she's the governor, and it's not her fault. It's not her fault. It's not her fault that there's 7.4% jobless rate here in this state either. But when you start adding all this stuff up that's happening to us, I just went by our local gas station, our Citgo station, where we always gas up.
That's right.
And
every time?
$3.09.
Today, okay.
Yeah, I'm stuck on 3.9. Right? $3.09, and there's no big outcry. But if you think, again, how does this erode people's budgets, particularly poorer people, that overall there's a median and average wage stagnation, so that as prices rise and taxes rise and cost of gasoline rises and all this stuff added together, well, this is not looking good.
Makes for some tough times for a lot of people.
So the brains behind it all, what they've done is to devalue the U.S. dollar. So now that the Canadian dollar is on par.
I heard that today. I read that.
You know, my elderly friend in Windsor, right?
Yes.
Who may be listening. Hola. Yeah.
Hola.
Oh, yeah. We used to kid with him and talk about the Canadian dollar as the peso, because,
right, exactly,
he's Spanish speaking. And he just said to me last night, he said, now the dollar is the peso. But on the other hand, what that means is that there's more of a tendency. In fact, there's a great tendency for other countries to import U.S. goods. So they'll be buying more U.S. goods, but things become more expensive for us because our dollar is worth less. That the euro now is up to like $1.40. Forget going to Europe, right?
Yeah. That's a big bummer.
In the meantime, all these big buyout firms like Carlyle, Bush's father and those guys, agreed yesterday to sell a minority stake to the Abu Dhabi government in a deal that reflects the growing financial power of the oil-rich Middle East.
Yeah, the ties just keep getting deeper and closer and more intertwined.
They just Carlyle just picked up $20 billion as they it says it strengthens the buyout firm's ties to the Middle East, which means we're going to be more and more tied in to an economy of oil, and oil has always meant war. We're in a war for oil, for nothing else. It's amazing. Just yesterday, the Bourse Dubai, it's a government-controlled exchange, agreed to take a 20% stake in NASDAQ. That's the American Stock Exchange. So we have this foreign government.
My God.
I mean, folks, this is going down the drain.
Yes, it is.
Rapidly. I don't have any big number for Bill Clinton and Al Gore in their 8 years, but things weren't like this. They weren't this bad. They've gone down the drain with these genius right-wingers in power.
Right.
And in the meantime, the Bush administration plans to increase its 2008 financing request for military operations in Iraq.
This is another $50 billion.
Another $50 billion, and a quarter of the additional money going towards armored trucks built to withstand roadside bombs, Pentagon officials said Saturday. Now your old pal Pete has a cheaper solution. Get the hell out of Iraq. You won't need these things.
It's pretty basic.
I said this is like, and the same thing with them accusing Iran of selling, or not selling, but giving weapons to the Iraqi Shiite militias to attack U.S. It's like, wasn't it the same as the other week about, I had this friend was saying, this goddamn bar, man, every time I go into it, I get into a fight. And he kept going back to this bar. And every other time he was in there, he'd wind up in some brawl. And I said to him, why don't you find another bar? He said, huh? Yeah.
that like it wasn't an alternative. What are you talking about?
Right.
I got you.
So
I get you.
But this is what it's all about. The military industrial complex. And we were talking about that last week, that this is not just a proper noun. It's the script of our economy. So the United States, and in our case, locally here in Michigan, we have a crisis that we cannot finance our state adequately without either cutting programs for the majority of citizens or charging us more.
Yes.
Yeah. You know, I was thinking of another thing. Why that? I'm always thinking about if we weren't spending these hundreds of billions of dollars in Iraq. Oh, yeah. How about this? Rather than a war in Iraq, how about giving our seniors more money for Social Security?
Ooh, such a radical concept.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, think about this. It's been $600-800 billion that's been spent so far, which has all gone into the pockets of these war industries, right? So these are all Bush's buddies, and it's increased the profits of all the oil company buddies of his, and on like that. And instead of a state that is figuring, wow, we've got an excess of money, let's put in a few more ferry lines across Lake Michigan and Lake Huron. Let's beautify every city in Michigan. Let's raise the quality of life for our citizens. Instead, it's going to be more money and going out for war, and it goes more and more and more. When the cost of CIA operations and embassy expenses are added, the war in Iraq currently costs taxpayers, it's you and me, about $12 billion a month, said Winslow T. Wheeler. He must be some commie. Let me see what he is. Oh, he's a former Republican congressional budget aide. He said, everybody predicts declines, but they haven't occurred. 2008 will be more expensive than 2007. It all depends on what happens in Iraq, but thus far it has continued to get bloodier and more expensive. Everyone says we're going to turn the corner here, but the corner has not been turned. In 2004, the two conflicts, the one in Afghanistan, cost $94 billion. $122 billion in 2006, and and this year they're going to say they're going to need close to $150 billion. So this then is the reality show again. How dumb are we?
Yes,
how
are they?
Yeah, are we going to stand for this? See, it works for them. It works for them. They make a fortune. People like us. Our sons and daughters die, and they go over there and they kill the sons and daughters of Iraqis. And there's misery spread across the globe, 6,000 miles away, courtesy of Bushco, this infernal racket that is expending our treasury for mass murder. This man and all the people in his administration are war criminals. There never was any reason for invading Iraq other than oil. And the final one in this little set, Bush, kids' health care will get vetoed.
Oh, Jesus.
Yeah.
Really?
He called Democrats irresponsible on Saturday for pushing expansion he opposes to children's health insurance program.
Oh, he's a real sweetheart.
Yeah.
God,
yeah.
Get him out.
Yeah.
Out! Impeach him now.
Yeah. Well, with that said, we can go to our phones because I think our first caller actually wants to talk about that. It's Jonathan. Jonathan, you are in, where is it, East Casco Township? Okay, go ahead, sir. You're on the air.
Yeah. See, I don't like Bush at all. The way I look at this war is, if you imagine three people standing like right next to each other.
Yeah.
And, let's say the guy to my right punches me, and I turn around and punch him. Does that make any sense? You know, it's kind of like the guy that punches me is Afghanistan, like with the original attack.
Right.
And you know, I turn around and I punch the other guy. And that just doesn't make any sense at all.
Well, here's what the United States should have done rather than getting trapped in a second war in Afghanistan. The United States, us, the people that suffered such a grievous attack on September 11, 2001, had every right to go in and destroy the bases from which these people launched their attack, or at least we thought they did. We're not even 100% sure of that. But the idea then to overthrow this government, in fact, one that Bush had been cooperating with, both when he was governor of Texas and as late as April of 2001, giving them tens of millions of dollars for poppy eradication, which they were all down with, right?
And a pipeline.
And a pipeline, Pipelandistan.
Pipeganistan.
No.
I don't remember.
Anyway,
yeah.
But fighting this war and just killing, again, thousands of Iraqis and all that doesn't make a bit of sense. But I hear you. I think your point is a good one. Thank you, Jonathan. All right, we'll be right back. Peter Werby, Jalene Jordan. This is the Night Call Show on WRIF. You want to call us in the meantime, 313-298-WRIF. That's
313-298-9743.
That's right. And for the shy, or if you can't get through, call talkyes@yahoo.com. Short emails appreciated.
The pictures,
the podcast,
the vlogs,
the special features you just can't get
anywhere else.
Super f***ing cool.
Get them online at WRIF.com.
I salute yourself.
Or check us out at MySpace.com/WRIF.
Guaranteed to be extreme.
Because we can always use more friends, and we won't be naked.
Does anyone else smell Astroglide?
101.
WRIF.
People are sexy and clever, and they always say something funny right before a commercial break.
Everything that rocks.
WRIF.com.
Night Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
All right, thank you very much, and joined by Jalene Jordan. Boy, folks are emailing us big time, aren't they? One of the things that I led with was the fact that country music is deserting George Bush. So when country music leaves him,
that's a pretty good sign.
He's gone.
Yeah. A big sign.
So Toby Keith and Daryl Worley have been putting out anti-war songs. And at the end of this account from the Sunday Telegraph, in fact, it's on my site if you want to read it, Peter Werby, W-E-R-B-E.com, said right-wingers said that he had damaged his credibility. And it said opponents of the war accused the singer of opportunism, taking just going with the wind.
Well, they just can't accept that perhaps he did change his mind.
Well, Kathy's listening in Green Bay, Wisconsin, and she wrote to say that wrote the call talk, yes, at yahoo.com. She said he's not opportunistic, Toby Keith. He's just showing that he's capable of learning. And he said he was a lifelong Democrat years ago. She says, I just didn't believe him.
It was hard to believe. I'm with you.
Yeah. I don't get, but she also said about the thing about why do these right-wingers always talk about the Democrat Party rather than the Democratic Party, mm-hmm. which is its name. And she says that she thinks that the word Democrat places the emphasis on rat? Democrat?
That's a theory I haven't heard.
In addition, people respond very positively to the word Democratic. Republicans can't have that. So, I don't know. It doesn't settle. Does anybody have an idea about that, why these right-wingers refer to the Democratic Party as the Democrat Party? And now Bush echoes that. I mean, this guy makes no attempt to be to any extent, even-handed. He uses the language of the far right wing.
Oh, yeah. Well, and he's well-trained.
Yeah. Do you have any email over there?
I do. Let's see. Bush is self-confident because he knows something most Americans refuse to even consider, which is he has no intention of leaving office.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Another big incident here. You think you wouldn't even realize that. What's his support on the war? I think it's like the confidence in his ability to handle it. That's not even among the right wing. It's like 5%.
Oh.
Yeah. And his overall support is below 30%.
Yeah, right.
That's pretty
bad.
Mike in Washington, D.C. is listening online. He says Democrats are anti-democracy. He said it's true. The party of Democrats is anti-democratic. That's why they successfully took Ralph Nader off the ballot in 2004 in a handful of states. They don't want you to have any choice but to vote for them. I know it's tempting to defend the Democrats when the Republicans strike, but remember, they are the corporate-owned enemy also.
You know, we were talking about the state. This one came in. I don't know if you've heard anything, but there is a rumor going around that some prisoners, nonviolent first-time offenders, are going to be released to save state money. This would be great news because I know someone who is a prisoner of the war on drugs, which never made any sense.
Well, yeah. I mean, that's another thing. If they would stop enforcing these ridiculous laws of people with small amounts of harmless drugs, or, you know, ones that are even harmful to people, it's not the government's business to say you can't do this or that drug. I mean, you should inform people that certain substances are harmful and can be addictive and what have you, but making criminals out of people that decide they want to change their consciousness with chemicals is not the role of government. And it turns out to be, we were talking about the military-industrial complex. What we're talking about here is the prison-industrial complex. Let the drug prisoners go. Let them out. One more, then we get back to our phones.
Agreed, Peter.
Sigrid writes us at calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Hi, Peter and Jalene. Please talk about Arlington Midwest. Now, that's a number of peace groups, including an Ohio group, have set up 4,000 tombstones to represent the American dead, including the ones that have committed suicide when they return. It's at Grand Circus Park in downtown Detroit, just a little south of the Fox. And the last day is tomorrow, and she's almost 4,000 tombstones, some for the guys that committed suicide, as well as a memorial for the dead Iraqis. The regular media has ignored it. I don't think you would. Well, we haven't.
No. Yeah. Here we are.
All right. So it's down there tomorrow. All right. We were talking, too, about the state of Michigan and the state of the state, the first state. Yeah, right. Here's Robin Flynn. Rob, thanks for waiting. Hi, you're on the air.
How you doing, Peter?
We're doing great.
You know, I have some comments about, you know, the economy in the state of Michigan right now.
Since 1991, this price, the tax on cigarettes has went from a quarter a pack to over $2 now. Where's that money at?
I don't know. Where's the money from the lotteries?
And, you know, and all these companies have left Michigan, Pfizer, Volkswagen, Comerica. And I know Volkswagen and Comerica, they didn't leave the United States. They just went to other states.
Yeah.
I'm not sure about Pfizer, but...
No, they're still here. Well, Volkswagen, they just, you know, they got a better offer, if you would. Although, I don't know what the deal was. I guess they wanted to be, they said they wanted to be near the center of things, which is no longer Michigan.
Our governor has chased every business out of Michigan.
You know, she hasn't done that. I don't have any real big number for Jennifer Granholm, but she, you'd have to really show me, Rob, what sort of policy she has.
Buick City.
What?
Buick City. You're not familiar with Flint?
Oh, Buick City.
Buick City.
Buick. I thought you said Duick.
Thousands of cars there every year, and they're gone.
Trust me, that is not the doing of Jennifer Granholm. I mean, do you think the General Motors and the spot they find themselves in has anything to do with Jennifer Granholm?
Oh, yeah.
It does.
Oh, yeah.
Uh-huh. How?
Take a drive. You're
No. I know what's happened. I mean, this has been going on, for quite a while. Remember Roger?
Roger Me?
Yeah. Yeah.
Come up here and take a drive through Flint.
No, it's not about that. Why can't you answer that question?
I mean, the question
how
is,
did she create this?
What are we talking about? What we got to talk about, Rob, is policy. How did the particular policies, for instance, the governor right before Jennifer Granholm, what did she leave? What did he leave the state with? And also, what policies has she promoted that has driven out business or? I mean, nobody has said that. Nobody has said, we're going to Virginia the way VW did because Jennifer Granholm's policies have created the situation. For one thing, up until 2006, it was a Republican-dominated legislature. All right, thank you so much. Appreciate it. But, you know, if you're at the top and things are going south, the tendency is
to blame you.
Yeah,
that's right.
And I mean, what was the option? This far right wing whack job, DeVos. Yeah, that would have been sharp.
No.
That would have worked. That would have worked. All right, here's Curtis. Curtis, you're homeless.
Yes.
Well,
hey, how you doing?
Good.
All right. Yeah, Jennifer Granholm. As you can tell, she is both dual citizenship, right?
She retains her Canadian citizenship, does she?
Yes. Am I right?
I don't know. What's the issue here?
Did Engler?
What, have dual citizenship?
Yes. And where's their jobs going?
Wait a minute. This makes a lot of sense. Now I finally figured this out. Governor Engler was only a citizen of the United States, so everything worked perfectly.
Oh.
And Jennifer Granholm is a citizen, was born in Canada, and may or may not still retain a Canadian citizenship. So that is why the economy of Michigan is in the pits.
Because she's a Canadian.
Good thinking, Curtis. And also, she is personally responsible for now the Canadian dollar being on par with the U.S. dollar. Thank you. Appreciate that. Good thinking on your part.
Okay.
All right. Let's see. Here is Bob. Bob's in Warren. Bob, thanks for calling 313-298-WRIF. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hello.
Hey, Bob.
Hey.
Hey.
My question is about the war itself.
Yeah.
Over in Iraq, and I just wanted to say real quick that I do support our troops 100%. And the only thing that
who
really
doesn't who
well,
doesn't
on the other hand I go ahead but that's a different thing. I'm not, what does that mean?
It means that I think insinuating that we don't because we don't support the war.
Go ahead.
Well, I just yeah, what does it mean? Go ahead.
What does it mean to support our troops?
I support our troops as far as, you know, that you know they have to do because they're in the service and they have to do what they're told.
So how did,
as far as supporting the war?
So do you think? Do you think that we don't support the troops?
No. He didn't say.
Oh
that.
No.
But I'm off. War. I'm off on something else. I'm saying that phrase that is so popular that has little or no meaning. And Bob, I'm not trying to put you on the spot because I think it would happen to almost anybody you ask. What specifically does support the troops mean? How does that turn out to be, an emotion? It's actually, as an emotion, it's understandable. Because the majority of people, and now it turns out the majority of troops, do not want to be there. They don't want to kill people. They don't want to wound people. They don't want to destroy Iraq further. They don't want to risk injury. They don't want to risk death. They will, because that's what they've signed on to, but that's not what they would. So our hearts can go out to people put in this untenable position that they've been placed in by a series of lies and manipulations of both them and, I mean, they're the cannon fodder. They're old-fashioned cannon fodder for these rich oil barons that Bush represents. But in terms of supporting the troops, I have no idea concretely in terms of policy what that means.
Well, the thing is what we're trying to do, the point that we're trying to bring across into Iraq is democracy.
No, that's absolutely not true.
It's a mess.
Why would you even think that? The only Bush says that doesn't make it true. Everything he says is a lie. So why would you think that that's what he's trying to do? He's not trying to. He has no interest in democracy. He has no interest in democracy in what's that other country? United States. They stole the election of 2000. They stole the election of 2004, and they're doing everything they can to drive voters off of the rolls. They're trying to mess further with the Electoral College, for instance, in California, where they're trying to rob the possibility of a Democratic victory in 2008. So these people, Bush and the rest of these fascists, have no interest in democracy in Iraq, and they couldn't because they would have to start to clean up their own house. All right, thank you very much. All right, let me tell you who does not support the troops. George W. Bush, the Republicans, all of these guys that make all the good noises about supporting the troops, that have little flag lapel pins, and that when they speak they have flags in back of them. There's an interesting site. It's called AWOLBush.com because, you know, Bush was AWOL. Dan Rather is suing CBS for $70 million, claiming that he was forced out when they had that story about Bush being AWOL from the National Guard and what have you, and that he was forced to make this humiliating apology for this story that was absolutely true.
Good for him.
I don't know about some of the documents. I couldn't even... the Bush administration versus Dan Rather, the contest didn't really interest me that much, although I knew that he was being jacked around.
Right.
And that he's correct that the CBS said, oh, no, this was back, in 2004, I think. But Bush absolutely, he got into the Texas National Guard through the connections of his father, along with the sons of other prominent Texas, I think maybe even Democrats, but for sure Republicans. Actually, Lloyd Benson. Also his son. This was just so their boys didn't have to go off and fight this hideous war based on lies in Vietnam. They got the playboy treatment to go into the Air National Guard. And then Bush was AWOL. Bush was AWOL. Go to AWOLBush.com.
It's a fact. Can't argue with those.
And if you can prove that actually Bush was not AWOL, that is that if you can find records that showing that he was actually at... wherever he was supposed to be, they'll give you $10,000. Yep. They're offering $10,000 for anybody.
I keep forgetting that.
Yeah. But here's who doesn't. But on the site awolbush.com, there's a heading called George W. Bush AWOL from supporting our troops. So I said I don't know exactly when people say support our troops what that means, but I know people that are kicking our troops in the ass. And that's George W. Bush. I mean, the tax cuts for the rich, war profits for Halliburton, or support for our troops is what this says here. Bush administration cuts $1.5 billion from military family housing. That was a couple of years ago. Bush administration underfunded veterans health care by $2 billion. Bush administration proposal would end health care benefits for 173,000 veterans.
He does not support the troops.
Yeah. Bush administration budget cuts force more than 200,000 veterans to wait long time for health care. Bush administration opposed plan to give National Guard and Reserve members access to health insurance. Bush administration cuts $172 million allotted for educating the children of military personnel. Bush administration tax cuts denies military families increase in child tax credit. How can these people have fooled so many people? And let me put it right to you, and I'm sorry for this because it's kind of embarrassing, but how could you have been fooled so badly? The information was out there. You know, you got driven by a lot of things, as I always say, by fear, by rage, by desire for revenge, for trust in leaders. Don't do that again. They're plotting more stuff. There's going to be other stuff like this in your lifetime. The younger you are, the more this is going to come around again. Because the Democrats will get in 2008 and they'll make things a little teeny bit better. But then they'll, you know, get back out. And these same maniacs, these right-wingers will get back in and they'll have us in some war. They'll invade Venezuela, or they'll invade Sri Lanka, or they'll invade Manchuria.
Cycle from hell.
Yeah, right, right. So don't, what, you know, we got to redo, Jolene, the theme music from this show. And I wanted to have, you know, that old classic rock tune from The Who, Won't Get Fooled Again.
Mm-hmm.
It should be, Don't Get Fooled Again.
Right, right.
Oh, my God.
Yes.
All right. Here's Louie in Westland. Louie, it's Peter and Jolene on WRIF. Go ahead, you're on the air.
Hey, hi, Peter. How are you?
I'm doing fine. How are you, Louie?
All right. It's been a long time. I've been actually listening to you for many, many years.
Okay. What kind of phone are you talking about?
A cell phone, actually. You it was on speakerphone. I took out the speakerphone.
Okay, it is better, Peter.
It's
just stop
better.
It.
All right, go ahead.
Go ahead.
The statement is, what are they doing with all the revenue from that oil that is Iraq's main source?
They're lining their pockets.
Well, of course.
Yeah, some of it, there's lots of it. I mean, some of it is going in to support the Iraqi government, but the U.S. And other nations in the West are trying to loot that because they're trying to get this oil law in that would change what had been in the Iraqi constitution that said that, like many countries have, Mexico and a lot of oil-producing countries, they say that profits cannot leave the country because there is such a long history of the Western nations and the United States and all that, looting the profits from these countries. I mean, they can make joint agreements, like even Venezuela, Chavez, he has all sorts of arrangements with U.S. and French and British oil-producing companies. But a lot of the oil and the refined oil and the gasoline is just sold on the black market. I mean, it's this enormous racket over there that I think they've had like 75 prosecutions of United States people for varieties of theft going into the tens of millions of dollars. Some, you know, with army personnel, with contractors. The contractors are the big guys. All right, we got to take a break. Thank you so much. Appreciate it. We'll be right back. 313-298-WRIF.
313-298-9743.
We'll be right back.
This is WRIF.com.
first floor. Turn the key and slowly unlock the door. As the man breathes into his saxophone, and through the walls you hear the city groan. Outside it's America. Outside it's America.
Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
Thank you very much, and welcome back to our second hour. Julian Jordan is with me in the WRIF studios.
That's right.
And you'll be able to see photographs of us on our MySpace page when? You're going to go right home and spend
it
the next
depends.
Couple
of
hours.
I'm a little tired.
I'm going right to bed.
Me
right
too, I think.
Ahmadinejad in the United States. Michigan economy in the what?
The tank.
In the tank. Thank you. That's good. I like that. In an hour, we're going to be playing some interviews I did previously with our. Did you know this? With our old pal Norman Solomon.
I did know that.
Yeah.
Yes.
Got a great title for his book, his memoir of an activist since he was 14.
Wow.
And it's called Made Love, Got War.
He's a cool man. He's very interesting. And he's with the Institute for Public Accuracy.
Right. He's the executive director. You can go to accuracy.org for that. It's Close Encounters with America's Warfare State. That's the subtitle.
He took Sean Penn to Iraq a couple of times.
Oh,
they're
yeah,
buddies.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, but I didn't even ask him about making love. Made Love, Got War.
I don't think he was being literal, do you?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
And you can go to my site right now if you want a little preview. Peter Werby, WERBE.com. And you can also, when you go there, you can go to the Night Call MySpace page and also Jolene's MySpace page as well.
Mm-hmm.
And, but it's, R-rated? Are your photographs on there?
Well, from the... They're in the pictures. They're not in the slideshow anymore.
Yeah. What, but,
yeah. I think I might have got shut down.
I was going to say.
I really think I was.
This was Jalene, host. Actually, you were one of the hosts of the... What was
Detroit Erotica Ball.
The
right.
Detroit Erotica Ball.
It's all in the name of working at WRIF. Come on now.
And art.
And art.
Yeah.
Get over it, people. Yeah. That's what I say.
But on here also it has the whole deal about the MoveOn.org petition. And MoveOn.org is fighting back. It says, I signed the petition. It says, I will not be quiet. I will fight back and I will keep speaking out until Congress forces an exit plan from this awful war. Oh, yeah, we haven't even talked about the March on Washington next Saturday, September 29th, that neither... me or Jalene is going to, unfortunately. I hope many of you do, though, as well. It says, make history, be part of it. You know, when you look back, you always, if you watch television, everything from PBS to just, you know, the mainstream channels, you always see history, the Civil Rights Movement or the anti-war movement or the labor movement or World War II or the 50s. You know... When your grandkids say to you, what did you do during, what is this, the aughts? What do we call this, you know, aught 8 or aught 7? You don't know? You know what I mean? You call it like the 60s or the 70s or the 80s.
Okay.
So what is this?
It's the thousands.
The thousands. The zeros.
it is the zeros. It's the negative zeros.
It's the negative. It's less than zero.
Yeah.
But, you know, your grandkids are going to say, so what did you do during the zeros? And you're going to say, well, yeah, I went to this huge march on Washington. I was part of the movement that ended this catastrophic war that is killing so many people and looting our treasury. Yeah. And then there was the taser incident. That's on my website as well. That this young man, Andrew Meyer, got up and started asking. Most of you have seen this by now, right? There was a lot of accounts that he was waving some book. You know the book he was waving?
No.
He was waving...
People's History of the United States?
No, Greg Palast's book.
Oh!
Armed Madhouse.
Right, okay.
It's Greg Palast, P-A-L-A-S-T. It's GregPalast.com.
He's amazing.
Yeah, he's amazing. He's an investigative reporter, one of the best in the world, and he can't get a job in the United States.
He lives in London, doesn't he?
I think he's here now in New York. But he does all this reporting for British papers and British television.
That's what I'm thinking, right.
Because they don't want to print his stuff. So
it's too true.
Andrew Meyer, and they're saying, oh, the guy was a showboater, and he talked longer than he should. Yeah, well, tase him. You know, it's at this taser. Well, 70 people have died in recent years because of being tased. And there is a taser. I don't know if you saw that on my website, a video of this insane psycho cop tasing this woman. It's really horrible. In fact, I even have one of those things, caution, on it. In some ways...
Yeah, I can't watch it.
You know what? I might even take it off. It's truly disturbing. I can't get this image. And it's bad enough, I mean, her being hurt. But then if you... You think I'm sick. I watched it twice.
Yeah.
It was just a minute and a half or something like that.
That's long enough.
But of course, I was fascinated... But in a grotesque manner about what was the injury that was being done to her. They're sending, 15,000 volts into her? But then the second time, I looked at this psycho cop. And he probably had to go back to the station house and change his underwear, you know? These guys are getting off on this, no doubt.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, definitely. They get off on it when we go to those marches. You can tell the ones that are really getting off on it.
Yeah, and that's probably 10% of the cops. I mean, when you look at the brutality statistics, the complaints against a police officer.
Small amount.
It's like 10% get 80% of the complaints.
Mm-hmm.
And because most cops, like the ones I know, when... they did just stand back when these cops start wading into them. Because now, you know, they 30 years ago or so, they developed like maces and these chemical
pepper
sprays.
Pepper spray, woo.
Pepper spray, yeah, that's fine. If you've never been pepper sprayed, folks.
The throat, it's just awful.
And they said this would stop people from getting clubbed. Of course, what the cops do is they mace you, then they club you. Or they taser you, then they club you.
Yeah.
Yeah. So there's all sorts of cases.
Fun stuff.
Yeah. There's all these cases about, these people that died. I mean, people that were on drugs, people that were having psychotic incidents. And these cops would come in and, hey, I got a taser gun. Napoleon said there's only one thing you cannot do with bayonets, and that's sit on them. In other words, he meant you have weapons of war, you have weapons of injury.
Use them.
You have the social permission to use them. You
Use them.
Absolutely. And there's actually been this debate about whether this Andrew Meyer in Florida should have been stunned with a taser gun. I mean, what did this guy do? I mean, I was at a Ralph Nader. In fact, I talked about this on the air. Ralph Nader, the same thing, last questioner. This woman got up and started talking about socialism and feminism and would not stop. And people started yelling and kind of booing at her. And Ralph Nader, who, whatever you think about him, is actually one of the nicest people in the world. He said, hey, let her talk.
Yeah.
People like that don't get to talk much.
Wow.
She kind of heard that and kind
probably took everyone aback a little
bit.
Right?
And it kind of took her aback.
Yes.
Because she was like saying everything she wanted to say and had felt that she was suppressed from saying.
Unheard, right.
Yeah. Yeah. So the idea that there are people out there that thinks it's okay to electrocute people because they're obstreperous, yeah, like that. How far have we come? I mean, why do the police?
How far have we gone?
Yeah, why do the police allowed to have these weapons of torture? And that's frequently. That's one of the things. I mean, there's 70 deaths, but you repeatedly hear about people being tortured by them in police stations. This is a weapon that should definitely be banned. And good for this Andrew Meyer. I mean, where was it, this thing? Something he said. He's a known prankster. His history of practical jokes, but that's not. He wasn't giving a practical joke. He was confronting John Kerry and said, "Look, you won the election in 2004, and I have this book here, Greg Palast's book, Armed Madhouse, and it talks about how the black vote was suppressed in Ohio by the Republicans." And Kerry's saying, "I know. I read the book." And all of a sudden, boom! And that's what he says. "Oh, my mic's turned off." And then when they grabbed him, now you would think, if he would have been smart, but he's 21 years old. Sometimes you get a little, like if cops would have grabbed me and that thing, I would have I wouldn't have gone limp like people do.
Yes, but you would have been a little more Tai Chi about things.
Yeah, I wouldn't have started up with him. But it's pretty outrageous that they grabbed him at all. They had no right to lay hands on him whatsoever.
Right.
And then when he physically objected, the cops could have done something. They could have just said, okay, we're letting you go. But instead, they electrocute him.
Mm.
Only in America.
Yeah.
All right. That's not true. That's not true. There are a lot of
America. Yeah, how about just that?
Yeah. I am terrible. Ronnie, my apologies to you. You're driving and you've been on hold for 36 minutes. I'm sorry.
Yeah, I'm on a big road out here. You know, I could go on forever. I've been listening to you guys. I don't even know what station it is. I have to apologize.
It's 101 WRIF FM Detroit.
Yeah.
Detroit. You know, you mentioned Detroit, and I thought about Jimmy Hoffa.
Okay.
I'm serious. I mean, there's a man that we need in this country if we could find where he is, but he'd be passed away by now, I would think. You talk about my industry and what it was at one time. And how things, if you watch the movie that stars Jack Nicholson, you get an idea of how the government and everything. I mean, you touch so many subjects today, and I'll go back to my 86-year-old father. You talk about support the troops.
Yeah.
These people in this country don't support the troops. Talk to any old veteran from World War II.
Sure.
And see how they whittle at their benefits. Watch this TV show where the newscaster got severely injured over there, and of course he had all kinds of money, but then he finally sat back and said to himself, hey man, I got some of the best help in the world here. What about the rest of these guys?
Yeah, well, that's another thing when we talk about the hundreds of billions that have been wasted on this illegal war in Iraq. People like your father and other veterans of all the wars could be getting so much better benefits than they are. But as I was reading before, the Bush administration has diminished the benefits given to veterans all down the line.
But you know what? You talk about the government. You know, you've touched on so many things that could go on forever. I mean, I run all 48 states. I see a lot of different things. I'm in Michigan every week.
Yeah.
Great state here. It's a nice place. I'm from Vermont, but we've got so many problems in the government. I hate to put a label on Democrats, Republicans. I don't think it makes any difference at all today. It's just a mess.
Well, it is a mess. I mean, there's been other periods in our history when things have been a mess. But this is a mess today. And just, I don't know if you, yeah, well, you're on hold. You heard how people were blaming the governor of Michigan for the, you know, what we find here in the economic situation and the budget crisis here in Michigan. Well, I would hope then that those same Republicans would similarly blame Bush for what's happening at a national level.
But you've had big, you know, I got to keep quoting my dad. I mean, I remember when the 911 happened. I'm a fireman. I was home when the towers came down. I knew we had hundreds of people in there and hundreds of firemen. And the first thing I wanted to do was go out and just wipe everything off the map, which I don't think is the correct thing.
No, I know.
But going back to what I said, boy, we're going in there, Dad. You know what my father told me?
What's that?
He says, Ronnie, he said, you're going to find out that it's not what you think it is.
Wow.
And I said, Dad, you're wrong. Well, he said, I've been wrong a lot of times, but he said, you wait. So we waited, and look where we are. My dad was 100% right. Of course,
yeah.
You know, a lot of our old people, boy, I tell you, they're smart.
They are. In fact, the older I get, the more I have that belief.
Wisdom.
Wisdom, yeah. Yeah.
But, you know, you touched on a lot. It's just a cotton-picking mess. I mean, you talk about health care. You talk about, you know, I was thinking about cigarettes the other day. You can't smoke in buildings anymore. Now, what was it? You start to think about a big lobby. It's the tobacco industry.
Yeah.
Huge.
I was just sitting outside watching a guy come out and have a cigarette. I was delivering somewhere.
Uh-huh.
And I thought, you know what? We got a powerful government when you can push the tobacco lobby around.
That's
I'm not saying it's good or bad.
No, I hear you, Ronnie. But what's happening with that is that these tobacco companies are just expanding their sales overseas so that these drug pushers, I was saying earlier about that we ought to release all these drug war prisoners. That would save the state of Michigan billions and billions of dollars a year. But the people that are selling these legalized drugs that are responsible for almost 500,000 deaths a year, you know, I'm sure you know, there are zero deaths a year from marijuana, from smoking marijuana, 500,000 from nicotine addiction, and we know that these companies have manipulated the content to make sure that we stay addicted to it. So those guys, I mean, I'm for sending those guys to jail, you know, the guys that run the tobacco companies, and they're getting flack here in the States, and people want smoke-free workplaces and talking about bars and all that. They just shift their efforts to other countries, so they're addicting people in the third world. Well, Ronnie, keep on driving. I got to move on. Thank you so much.
Okay, I just want to say one thing. You mentioned Toby Keith, but you know these people have made a lot of money off and singing certain kinds of songs.
They did.
It's easier for them to change their mind than it is you and I.
That's right. Well, I've been listening to my dad more and more lately, so it sounds like you're on the right track as well. Thank you, Ronnie. Thanks for joining us. Thanks for calling 313-298-WRIF. A little earlier, I mentioned that President Bush again called Democrats irresponsible on Saturday for pushing an expansion he opposes to a children's health insurance program. And I forgot about this little item here. The United States has the second worst newborn death rate in the modern world. 2 million babies die in the first 24 hours each year worldwide. And the United States has the second worst newborn mortality rate in the developed world. American babies are three times more likely to die in their first month as children born in Japan, and newborn mortality is 2.5 times higher in the United States than in Finland, Iceland, or Norway, according to Save the Children. Only Latvia. God, I know, good. We're not taking up the bottom completely.
Right.
Had a higher death rate for newborns in the United States, which is tied near the bottom of industrialized nations with Hungary, Malta, Poland, and Slovakia.
Okay, and so what are you attributing this to, Peter?
Well, we're saying, I always say, what are we number one in? What are we number one in?
Nothing's good.
Well, how about this? And people would agree. The United States is the most armed country in the world.
Number one.
USA.
Yeah.
90 guns per 100 people. Who the hell is out there that's not armed? There's 10 people of every
100.
Well, you know, there's a lot of people, friends of mine, they have lots of guns.
No guns in my house.
No guns. Yeah. Okay.
Just three very fierce dogs will kick your ass to try to come in.
But this, Bush is essentially presiding over Murder Incorporated in Iraq, and now with our babies, too. I mean, one of the things is, I guess this is Al. He says, I don't have a gun. With you or
RL?
Yeah,
our producer.
Yeah.
Oh, good, he's with us.
Yeah,
with me. Well, oh, me. Okay, fine.
I'm a gun owner.
I know.
Yeah, I know that always shocks.
I know.
Shucks.
Many.
UAW said it.
Because people think you want to take away their guns, Peter.
No, Mal, most of... Never mind. Here's Marianne in Dearborn. Marianne, hi. It's Peter and Jolene.
Hi, Peter. Both Bush and Dick Cheney are made men. The Sopranos could take lessons from them.
There you go.
I was wondering, these thinhead Republicans are going to have a presidential debate in Dearborn in October, and I was wondering if there's anything planned for that, any kind of a protest.
Any kind of protest? I don't know. Oh, yeah, you know, actually, I saw something along the lines. Has there been protests at other Republican debate sites?
No, I have not. I have protested the war in Washington, D.C., but I've never done that.
No, that's not what I asked. I said I wondered whether you knew whether there had been.
Oh,
yeah.
What I was asking.
Yeah. Had there been at the other Republican debates? They're coming to Dearborn. Wow. They actually were getting quite a few Arab American votes, but I think they're goners now. They're not going to get too much. The number of Arab American businessmen I know in this area, in Dearborn, where you're from, backed Bush in 2000, figuring, hey, you know, they're going to be part of the new regime, the new conservative Republican regime. But, of course... No, it's Jeremy, and he doesn't own a gun. That's
okay.
Okay, Jeremy.
If anybody is planning on picketing, they better be careful, because Dearborn doesn't play. Because I was planning on picketing myself.
You're going to picket yourself?
Right.
That's a new one.
I mean, I was thinking of, just taking my little sign out there and letting you know how I feel.
Yeah, well, that's good. That's always a good thing. Thank you, Marianne. Appreciate your call. Now, what are the two debates that the Republicans have skipped? They skipped the Univision Hispanic one, but there was a second one. It was, was it at a black college? I think so. At Spelman College in Atlanta. Yeah, they're just cutting there. You know, the only minority group, what wasn't that in Maureen Dowd's column? She's the only minority group now represented in the Republican Party is gays.
Right.
Yeah.
That's right.
We haven't talked about Senator Wyde's stance, have we?
No, we haven't.
Tomorrow, I think, is the day where, or soon, this week at least, because he said he's leaving the Senate on September 30th, but he's Senator Wyde. This is the guy, the guy caught in the bathroom that's now a tourist attraction in the Minneapolis airport where he was giving signals. And, everybody, all the liberals, too, particularly, have said, look, this guy didn't do anything. At worst, the worst thing he did was to give kind of romantic, if you call that romantic, romantic signals. I mean,
he was just trying to get a little something, something.
Well, I know, but I'm saying why it's not. It wasn't about romance and sort of sex in a toilet. I don't know. It's not my.
I know it's not your thing.
Some people say get it where you can, but it's not. Not a high. I mean, I'm more into glasses of wine.
Yeah, a fire.
You put Journey on the thing.
Journey. Oh,
that's
God.
What I was. That's what I used to tell women all the time. Oh yeah, Journey's my favorite band. Falls too.
Journey.
Well, we're gonna tell you. You're not gonna tell a woman that you're. Your favorite band is Megadeth or Slayer.
Well, some of these guys would. And you know what? There's a lot of women who dig it just as much as those guys.
Let's put Megadeth on the box, baby.
How about a little John Mayer or something?
Yeah,
I don't know.
Right. Let's see. Where are we? Here is Fred in Detroit. Fred, thanks for calling 313-298-WRIF. You're on the air.
Good morning, guys.
Hi.
Hi.
I was just calling. Well, originally I was calling about what I've been reading concerning America's short-term memory of 9/11. But your last few callers have kind of pissed me off with regard to the state and budget, the governor.
What do you think?
And all the blame they want to throw in her direction.
All right.
Because clearly we noticed one trick industrial pony that we've had going on here, that started into decline long before she got in office.
They listen, Fred, if you read some of the stuff about the industrial decline of the Detroit area in Michigan, they place it in the 1950s. I mean, it goes back that far. It started declining then.
Right.
Yeah. So it's not Engler's fault.
And currently, you know, she could have never done anything to stop all of these businesses from, you know, from leaving that want to leave. And that's partly has to do with, you know, unionization in the state.
Sure. I mean, these companies, that's why they began leaving in the 1950s, that these small shops that were suppliers to the UAW figured out, or not the small job shops, but the parts suppliers, figured out, wait a minute, why should we pay decent middle-class wages to hard-working men and women in Detroit where we can go, not that they didn't go to China or Mexico then, we can go to Alabama, we can go to North Carolina, we can go to Arkansas and get people to work for about half. And then they figured it out, wow, it's even cheaper in Mexico. It's even cheaper in China. So it's not about Jennifer Granholm. It's about these companies that have no responsibility to the states in which they were located, but rather just, you know, the ugly dollar.
Well, before I go, I want to pose this question to your conservative Caucasian, to that part of your audience. How do you reconcile being unionized and Republican? I'd like to know.
I know. It's kind of pathetic. Well, you know, I'll tell you. Part of it was the single issue stuff, like in 2000, where I forgot what percentage, because Jolene and I used to work for the UAW network. We had a nationally syndicated show on that at the beginning of the zeros from 2000 to 2003. And I forgot what percentage of UAW the members voted for Bush, but it was like 40% or something like that.
I didn't realize that.
Yeah, maybe not 40%, but at least like a third. You'd think it would be like 2%, but a lot of it was single issues. A lot of it was, you know, they were jerking guys around with, you know, that the Democrats, you know, Al Gore wants to take your gun away, and some of it was about abortion and what have you. And here are men and women that voted against their own best interests. I don't understand that, Fred.
I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, all right, sir. Thank you very much. Thank you for joining us. Appreciate it. And let's see. Let's go to Lars. Lars is in Madison Heights. Lars, thanks for calling 313-298-WRF. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, Peter and Julian. I met at the showing of No End in Sight.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Let me know. Wait, before you say that, Lars is saying that Julian and I hosted a local showing at the main theater in Royal Oak, a Detroit suburb, of the documentary called No End in Sight about the Iraq War. And we did meet Lars and many other people as well. A couple hundred folks showed up.
Well, I wanted to give you guys an update on my disability status, the VA.
Okay.
About 2 weeks ago, in my checking account, I noticed that there was a check for $4,800 from the U.S. Treasury, and it's back pay for the past year I've been out of the Marine Corps. They've assigned me a 30% disability rating and level 2 priority, which means I'll get I'll get $350 a month as well as free medications from them based on our yearly evaluations as long as I have dysthymia.
So you should get more.
Yeah, probably. But now I'm hoping I'll be able to get money from the GI Bill because I'd probably get like a couple of grand back pay for that plus about $1,100 a month for every year I go to college, or every month I go to college full time.
$1,100 a month? Okay,
yeah.
So that's only about $250 a week, isn't it? Yeah. Well, so what is your point, Lars? That the benefits aren't so bad?
Well, that's just I just letting you guys know because I was discharged for a personality disorder. I thought I probably wouldn't get anything because I'd heard and seen another documentary that guys who had PTSD were diagnosed as bipolar and then told that they didn't qualify for any benefits.
Great.
But I've heard that they might have changed the rules because they're getting so much bad publicity for turning their backs on disabled veterans.
Yeah, so it's all about publicity. It's not about the needs of people that they sent off to war.
Not actually wanting to fulfill those needs.
All right, thanks for the update.
Thanks,
Keep
Lars.
Us informed, Lars. Yeah. Let's go to Sonny in Ypsilanti. Sonny, it's Peter and Jolene on WRIF. Thanks for joining us.
Yes, hi, Peter.
Hi.
I've got a nice program.
I like it
because it doesn't have a lot of chewing and chawing and stuff like that.
Yeah, it does. It's full of it. What do you mean?
But I was just telling this young man when I answered the phone, I'd like to pull a little joke. You know this one that you said about the guy in the bathroom?
Senator Weinstein.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Did you really mean get it while you can or get it in the can?
Sonny.
You were thanking.
Yeah, all right. Yeah. Thank you, Sonny. And even can has a couple double meanings. Wow.
Okay.
Oh, this is good. I want to hear from Jim in Davidson, Michigan. Jim, hi. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning, Julian and Peter. How
good
are
morning.
You?
Hi.
Yeah, I wanted to touch on the Lena Sick. I got a lovely hour full of that on CNN the other night. I sat there and sat and watched and just became more disgusted and more disgusted and more disgusted over the overblowing of something that could be easily fixed. But I swear to God, the most held-back people have to run in there and stir up the biggest pot of stupidity that's ever been created on the planet of Earth.
What, I'm not, you know, are you at the seashore? That's what it sounds like. You've got, like, all these waves going. You're talking about what happened down in Gina, Louisiana.
Yes.
The big march.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
There we go.
Yeah.
Sorry, my headset picked up everything.
Oh, okay.
No, I just was seeing that and just wondered if you guys have felt the same way, that this, you know, now a year later is just being so overblown just for publicity and whatnot.
No, I don't think it was done for publicity. The fact that there was this incredible outpouring of African Americans, and unfortunately, I thought it was very unfortunate that, of course, I didn't go and Jalene didn't go, that it was 90% African Americans that took part in this. And the kind of justice that is still meted out to people of color means that after 50 years of fighting civil rights struggle, that things still haven't come to the place where they should be. And the fact that you know, they still don't let this kid out on bond, it's, you know, like, you know, it's just amazing that, I mean, the whole case, though. There would have been six young men who would have gone to jail for attempted murder if it hadn't been for this incredible outpouring of sentiment, really, across the board. So my hat's off to those folks. All right, we got to take a break. Thank you very much. That's right. Wrong button there. I just got rid of myself.
There's a lot of buttons over there.
Yeah, a lot of buttons over here. I'm glad it's not, you know, 727.
Right. It's best you're just running the radio board.
That's why I got in this business instead of to be a pilot. We'll be right back. Peter Werby, Jalene Jordan, 313-298-WRIF.
313-298-9743.
You're listening to WRIF.com.
double cherry pie. Yeah, there she was, like disco superfly. I smell sex and candy here. Who's that lounging in my chair? Who's that casting Defia stares in my direction?
Now, Night Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
All right, thank you very much. And joining me, Jalene Jordan. Got some emails into calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Which is yours about the tasering incident?
Yes.
The college student that got tasered because he was asking impolite questions and was going on a bit to John Kerry. Because when the master is up there, you don't ask impolite questions.
Right. And yeah. James in Kenosha wrote in and said, the taser incident for me is a perfect illustration of an issue discussed a bit earlier, that being how we the people are so easily taken in by our would-be leaders. And then he goes on to talk about how John Kerry did nothing to intervene.
Yeah.
And also said, it brought to mind dark frozen nights canvassing for Kerry thanks to Move On's organizing in 2004. Damn it, fooled again indeed.
Yeah. And Roderick writes in, hi, you two. I think the cops that taser people should have, if they're guys, they're crotch nuts hooked up to 1,200 volt wires.
Yowza.
And fried.
Ow.
Use them as nipple clamps for women cops. Jesus, this guy here, it's wacky as these cops that use those things.
Were you at
man.
The Detroit Erotica Ball?
Yeah. About a bunch of other things. Yeah, this planet has got a lot of wacky crap in it. What a place. Yikes. But from Dean. Dean writes in, Peter, let me get this straight. From now on, when someone is resisting arrest, the cops are supposed to stop and let that person go so they don't have to escalate the use of force. Brilliant idea. You must have a huge criminal following, as I'm sure they'd all love the idea. Police officer safety be damned. Also, out of all the forms of non-lethal force, a tasing is usually the least abrasive form. Educate yourself, then speak further. Okay, Dean. I wish I had time to sit on hold for a little while, but a simple email will have to suffice this time around. Well, good, because good for you, or, you know.
Lucky you.
Yeah, lucky you. Now, here's a couple things I'm getting at. These torture devices are used in that manner, and hundreds and thousands of people have had taser guns used on them inappropriately. When do police have the right to use force on people to effectuate an arrest? Well, you know, there's all sorts of rules that are binding here. But partly it's situational. That there's no reason in the world that these cops should have put their hands on Andrew Meyer in Florida. And when he started thrashing around like that, what were they arresting him for? Talking too much? Asking impolite questions of John Kerry? Come on. There was no reason to do that. And there's just, I think you go to my site, peterwerby.com, and you can see case after case after case where people were tasered inappropriately. Electrocuting people should not be an option. And you go to one of them, and you know that these guys are into torture. Who do you think torturers are? Where do you think torturers come from in every country that allows torture? They're cops. That's who are the police in almost every country in the world that takes part in that kind of assault on people's basic human rights. You know, so you got to control the police. You got to control people that have power over people. That's why in the United States, in the Constitution, that says there shall be no cruel and unusual punishment. That's why there are such restrictions. Of course, I don't know how much they're carried out. So many restrictions on government because there are people that have power over you. And the founding fathers were extraordinarily wary because of what they had experienced in Europe. And what they knew is the history of absolute power of the executive in Europe. And it was in, you know, false imprisonment, seizure of property, searching without warrants, cruel and unusual punishments, and on and on and on. And they knew that the executive branch of which the police are part had to be restricted greatly. Now, I know, I wouldn't say I know a lot of cops. I know several. And I've never heard one of them that said, I want the right to taser people.
Yeah.
You know, I don't want the, I don't want to have to read people their rights. Or what are they always saying? Or I don't want to, this or that. Every police officer I know, that when you talk about rules that would constrain behavior within a set of decent rules and laws and policy, they're okay with it. Because they know they can enforce the law. The cops that are dangerous are the ones that want to do whatever they want. The Blackwater guys, like in Iraq.
Yes.
The hot dogs. The guys that you know love shooting out of cars and shooting down Iraqi civilians. Just like here, you got cops that love clubbing people. And, well, I'll put it this way. They love tasering people. And if they don't have a taser, they love macing people. And if they don't have a mace, they club people. And if they don't have a club, they just kick the crap out of them with their boots.
There's always rubber bullets.
Yeah, there you go. Oh, yeah, I forgot about those little wonderful things as well. All right, let's go on here. Let's go to Jim in Ann Arbor. Hello, Jim. It's Peter and Jalene on WRIF. You're on the air.
Peter, it's been a long... Hold on one second. It's been a long time, Peter, since I've talked to you, and, you know, it's always fascinating to listen to you, and I really am having a hard time. You know, I really don't want to criticize you because I'm not a Republican. I'm not a conservative. Yeah, guys. I drive a cab, so I'm letting these people out. Sorry. yeah, right, yeah. Okay, thank you. Anyways, Peter, you know, I had such a hard time when I'm listening to you lately with this giant brush that you paint on specific groups of people. And like I said, I'm a Democrat. I voted for Gore. I love Bill Clinton. I thought he was the best president we ever had.
So, wait. You think he was better than Roosevelt?
Well, yeah. Okay. Peter, I'm only 40, okay? So I'm going to go back to my history. I love Carter, actually, now that I think about it, but I was only 7. So,
hey, but wait, anyway. So who am I? What kind of group am I targeting?
Peter, you always paint, you preface things like the illegal war. You say the elitist rich. You know, and that bothers me in a lot of different ways.
It is an illegal war, though.
Well, you know, whatever. Well, I'm not going to argue with you about that statement because we don't have time. But the problem is, when you say the elitist rich and you say stuff like that, and you make Bill O'Reilly sound like he was schooled in neutral talk. And then
Wait.
We're trying to be precise here. I mean, I put a lot of emphasis on precision in language because the language is being destroyed through the mass media and manipulation by politicians. You're trying to tell me there's not an elite, there's not a class of rulers that can be called the ruling class that erodes the democratic process, that in fact has made it almost impossible?
Look, Peter, let's just stick with one issue. I won't argue with you with one.
Wait,
this is Peter's show, and he can direct that for you.
But wait a minute. You said that I was this broad brush.
You were painting these
rich elites, the bosses, the employers, what are you saying?
We're not saying every single person who has money is bad.
We've got a nice employer. We love our employer.
Yeah.
We actually do.
I know a lot of people who have a lot of money in their really great people.
Yeah, so do I. And a lot of them are in Hollywood.
Yeah, that's funny. But the problem is, when you say that, Peter.
Yeah.
When you say that, there is a lot of rich people. And when you say that they want us all to be poor, okay, that just defies logic because if there's no middle class, there is going to be no wealth making. Okay?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Here's how they do it. For one thing,
there is really no middle class anymore, by the way. I mean, it's very small. It's narrowed. Yeah, I was getting a little drastic.
I'm in it.
Right. It's you and it's me and a few
that's
others.
Right. Well, that's the idea. The idea is if everybody's wages are being driven down, how are people even going to afford to buy the products that they produce? In other words, that there's always a great encouragement for auto workers to buy the automobiles that they produce, which is kind of weird and cyclical, but whatever. But you can say, well, if they make a Ford cost $28,000 and they want to cut the wages of like the people in the supplier plants like Delphi by half is what they're talking about doing, even while they're giving tens of millions of dollars to the executive, how are the workers going to be able to afford a GM or a Ford or Chrysler car? Well, if it's the Guatemala model Jim, and that is that you only need about a third, two things. One, you have about a third of the population that's well-waged. Prices have gone up extraordinarily, and so it's that third that really moves the economy along. And then, of course, there's globalization, so that a lot of the profits for these big corporations are come from overseas. So these guys are a racket. Okay, thank you. Here's another Naser. It's time to go home.
Yeah.
Taser.
Yeah.
Taser, right. Those are both small sailboats, by the way. Tasers and lasers.
Oh,
yeah.
Didn't know.
A black teenager in New York City who was tasered four times in addition to being hit with a nightstick and put in a chokehold while his father, a 20-year veteran of the New York Police Department, was watching. And he says the cops used excessive force on my son. Do you think?
Yeah.
All right. Here is Tom. Tom's in Berkeley. Tom, it's Peter and Jolene. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, Jolene. Hi, Peter. How you doing?
Good,
Tom. Good.
Yeah, I just wanted to talk about a political science class I had about 20 years ago.
What's that?
Best class I ever had, man. It woke me up. And, you know, I was brainwashed all my life up until then. And the guy was talking about how the 1%... of the wealthy, like 1% of the country, 1% of the world, and pretty much the country here, it makes the money, and they spend it, and then the piddly people like us pay it all back.
Yeah, and get it, the wealth we do produce, that we're so underpaid, the majority of American people, and then great amounts of it are taken from, you know, are transferred, our wealth is transferred through taxes back to these big corporations,
right.
Particularly when you have a military-industrial complex, a prison-industrial complex, you know.
Mm-hmm.
That all work. Where did you take the class, in high school or college? Or?
Yeah, college is a... Like a two-year college.
Yeah, which one?
WCC.
Okay. Wayne County Community College. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a good class.
Yeah, well, good.
The teacher said he's blacklisted and everyone thinks he's a communist and stuff.
Do you remember his name? Probably a friend of mine.
I was going to say, we must know him.
Yeah. You want me to say it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Ron Spanauer.
Yeah.
You know him?
No. Sounds familiar, actually, yeah. but I don't know.
He was awesome, man.
That's good.
Cool. Yeah. Glad you got something out of it.
All right. Thanks a lot. Appreciate your call. Hear more on the Kerry tasering. But unfortunately, it wasn't Kerry that got tasered, though. Jessica from Washington Township. Jessica, hi. It's Peter and Jolene. You're on the air. Oh, sorry. Go ahead. Sorry. You're on the air.
Hi, I just wanted to say that I saw the video myself on AOL,
uh-huh.
And actually, if you listen really, really closely in the background, you can hear Kerry say to the police and the security guards, saying, no, that's okay, I'd like to answer his question.
Yeah,
I was listening when you mentioned that, you know, you didn't hear Kerry say anything to stop it, but he actually did.
When they shut off the mic and when they grabbed him, he was saying, no, I'll answer the question, which actually, I mean, think about this. It would have been extraordinarily interesting to hear Kerry's answer. I don't know why he could have answered it. A different venue, but the guy that got tasered, Andrew Meyer, was asking him why didn't he fight harder after the 2004 election, which Kerry knows was stolen from him by George W. Bush.
Well, of course, yeah. We all know that.
it was also James from Kenosha who wrote in and said that it wasn't Peter and I who said that.
Oh, okay.
John Kerry did nothing. That was from a listener.
But Jessica, I've been listening to like liberal talk shows, national shows, and that has been a constant criticism of Kerry that he did not intervene. And he did say initially, I can't get audio up on here. It's on my website, Peter Werbe, werbe.com. And you can see it, but he kind of drops out of it. You know, there's actually, and a friend of mine said he didn't see anything funny about this, but somebody put that the visuals of this kid in Florida getting tasered, along with the soundtrack from And what was it called? The Search of the, for the Holy Grail, the Monty Python.
Oh, yeah.
So they're all, so Carrie and Andrew Meyer, they're all speaking Monty Python lines.
Your friend didn't like that, huh?
No. No.
Okay.
But, like, I wasn't here when, like, I wasn't here when the election happened, so I don't know, you know, what happened really with Carrie and Bush. I happened to be in China at the time. But, so I just, you know. So I don't know much about happened that with the election, but I have heard a lot since I have been back and everything. Well, but at the same time, I also wanted to mention to you that, you know, I've also been to Venezuela, and I do, you know, I have seen what the gas has done for them as well. So, because I was able to stay with a couple of the families who have been helped out.
All right.
Yeah.
With what's happened with gas and things like that.
Buy Citgo.
So when you buy Citgo, that's
yeah,
what
it helps out the poor.
Thank you, Jessica.
Thank you.
No problem. Thank you. Bye.
Peace.
Appreciate it. Here, Jacob, writing from Oulu, Finland, writes, he's listening to us on the internet, just to let you know that last week a U.S. family has landed in Helsinki and asked for asylum. The U.S. family applied for refugee status in Finland. The family consists of a husband, wife, and three small children. I do not know yet whether the husband is a military man and he would be treated as a deserter. The Finnish Foreign Ministry is handling the case but not giving specific details. However, they came through Germany, as in they have to be returned to Germany. So the Foreign Ministry spokesman said they do not think they have ever before had an application from a U.S. citizen for
asylum.
Asylum, yeah. Advice to others, they want to seek refuge in Finland, fly direct to Finland. Okay, I'm for it.
Yeah, thank you for the tip. Can we stay at your house?
Hey, he's all for it.
Yeah, great.
Jacob has invited us before.
Jacob.
But I think we have to, you know, it's above the Arctic Circle.
Okay.
So
what?
Well, you don't want to, I don't think I want to go in like in January.
Okay.
Yeah, that's all. That's all.
No problem.
All right, here's Jim in Dearborn. Jim, it's Peter and Jolene. Hi.
Hey there.
Hi.
They announced on the news 11 a.m. strike deadline for GM.
Oh, really?
So.
Wow.
I don't think, but then they say, oh, everything, they're still talking, so.
Yeah, so they actually have set a deadline.
Yeah. Hmm.
I wonder what kind of cards the UAW still has. I mean, this is a period of labor is at an extremely weak position, so that we're taking plenty hits, but whether we're organized into unions or not.
Well, when the contract expired, I was working on the line at midnight, and they stopped the line 10 minutes before in case we walked out, and I'm just a temporary worker, and I said, what are we striking for? And no one knows. We don't know anything about the contract at all, the workers.
Well, usually what happens is that this is negotiated. And I think there's input from the locals, and if you're a temporary, you haven't been part of that process, but the locals send up, the ideas that they have, but most of it is controlled pretty centrally from Solidarity House, the UAW headquarters.
But they said before, for other contracts, they've gone through the plants during the negotiations and updated people. And they haven't said a word about anything.
Huh.
So, but, you know, those guys can fly their corporate jets to Washington and complain how poor they are while they want to take the guy making $50,000 and take it out of his pocket instead of their own.
Yeah, that's true. Well, it'll be curious to see how this all shakes out because the UAW, I mean, they've lost like two-thirds of their membership. Of course, the union I belong to, the American Federation of Television and Radio Artists, we've lost an extraordinary number of people as well. I mean, our membership just in Detroit has gone from 400 to 250.
Wow.
And
decline
there. Yeah, I mean, people say, well, why should I pay people union wages when I can get them for I get people to work for non-union wages. Here's Tim in Port Huron. Hi, Tim. You're on the air.
Hey, Peter. How are we doing this evening?
Great.
Hey, I've been talking with some people about the 2008 election recently, and everyone's big concern is with Barack Obama, who I'm a big supporter of. They're concerned that he's maybe not experienced enough to run the country, and I've been telling them maybe that's the change that this country needs to. I don't know, give Washington a shot in the butt and maybe to get this country moving in the right direction. Do you have anything like you could add to that, maybe that I can just share with them.
Well, let's, I mean, you know, one could argue, look at the last inexperienced guy that that ascended to the Oval Office, George Bush, and what a disaster he was. But Barack Obama is smart. He's inquisitive. He knows things. He reads. So that puts him in a much different class than the guy that grabbed power illegally for the last two elections.
Right.
So I don't know. That doesn't strike me as much of you know, much of a criticism. But I mean, that's going to be, look, this is all going to be politics. So they're going to say, oh, you know, he's too young, he's too inexperienced, and what have you. All right, I got to run because I got one more call to get, and then that's it for this portion of the show. Let's go to Brent. Brent, hi. It's Peter and Jalene. You're our last caller. You only have about 60 seconds, so go.
That's okay. My question is, I wonder why the government doesn't pull back our troops and utilize the money they've been spending to basically protect the southern border and the northern border of the states, have our troops back home, back with their families, and utilize the immigrants that are illegal aliens that are here to build that fence.
I was going to say, are we wanting to go to war with Canada and Mexico?
Let's round them up. Let's round up 12,000 people.
Let's do that whole put them to their own island thing.
We'll put them in a camp.
Okay, a camp. That would, yes, Peter.
We'll concentrate them in a camp, and then we can force them to build this wall.
Maybe we'll sell them a casino.
There you go.
Something like that.
Thank you, Brent. My. Bad idea. All right. Thanks for listening. Yeah, right. Man. Yeah, that's not the problem. Remember I was talking about that last week. Hispanic workers coming from Mexico and countries farther south is not the problem. It ain't the problem. All right.
More next week.
Yeah, that's not why people are losing jobs in Michigan. It's not why the auto jobs, not why VW left or anything like that. All right. Stay tuned for the interviews. I think you'll enjoy them. And Jalene Jordan, thank you so much.
Thank you, Peter.
Thanks to all of you for listening and calling, and we'll do it next week.
This is WRIM.com.
101 WRIF presents the return of the Riff's Trigger Free Concert featuring Hell Yeah. Hell Yeah, with special guests O-Tip and Blood Simple. October 30th at the Fillmore Detroit. Devil's Night has never rocked so hard in the D. Come rock with a Riff. Check out the vendor village inside the Fillmore. And get in on the Trick or Freak Costume Contest with a $1,000 grand prize. Tickets for the Riff Trick or Freak Bash are just $2,101. On sale right now at all Ticketmaster outlets. Charge at 248-645-6666 or Ticketmaster.com. October 30th, the Fillmore rocks. The Riff's Trick or Freak Concert featuring Hell Yeah. From who else but your concert station in the Motor City. 101 WRIF. Every rocks. We're back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. It's a pleasure to be with you. I was looking at one of my favorite sites the other day, commondreams.org. They always have terrific material on it, much of it gleaned from the mainstream press. And there was an op-ed piece in the Baltimore Sun, which is a daily paper in Baltimore. It appeared August 21st, and it was called The Quiet Campaign Against Birth Control. And I thought, did I read this right? I thought maybe it was something else, because birth control certainly is something that's established in American culture, American society, and there are people that have religious objections to it, and the way they deal with it is they don't use birth control. But the fact that there is a campaign against it is an incredible story. Joining me is the author of the op-ed piece, Christina Page. She's the author of How the Pro-Choice Movement Saved America, Freedom, Politics, and the War on Sex. And boy, that subtitle's got a lot in it, doesn't it? She's a spokeswoman for birthcontrolwatch.org. Christina Page, welcome to the Peter Werby Show.
Hi, Peter. How are you?
I'm doing great. Well, a quiet campaign against birth control. Who in the world is doing that? The Catholic Church, I don't think, campaigns against it anymore, does it?
Well, you know, it's kind of the newest incarnation is, you know, really the Right to Life movement is campaigning against contraception. What we have today, I mean, first of all, there's not one pro-life organization in the United States that supports birth control, which is a shock to most Americans, considering that birth control is the only proven way to reduce abortion. But instead, what we have is really well-financed, increasingly more successful, and a underway campaign to roll back access, Americans' access to contraception. One technique is to try to reclassify the most commonly used forms of contraception as abortion. And so what we see...
Wait. What? How can that be? How can birth control stopping pregnancy be conflated with abortion?
Well, exactly. There's no scientific evidence to suggest that birth control can work that way, but what we have are Right to Life groups, and now what my article was about, Right to Life candidates, presidential candidates, who are claiming that the birth control pill, the emergency contraception, any hormonal method of birth control can prevent a fertilized egg from implanting in the womb, which there's no scientific evidence it can, but it's also important to note that even if it did, which it doesn't, that's not the definition of when pregnancy begins. A fertilized egg is not, there's no known moment in which a fertilized egg can be known. There's no test that a woman can take that would indicate that she has a fertilized egg in her system. It's at implantation that pregnancy begins, and every reproductive health expert in the world agrees that that is the moment pregnancy begins, and conveniently it's the first time pregnancy can be known. But instead what the Right to Life movement is trying to do and wants you to believe is that pregnancy begins at an unknowable moment, at a fertilization, and that the birth control pill and every other hormonal method can prevent the fertilized egg and implanting in the womb. Both of these things are not true.
Hmm. Now, Christina Page, you're actually being very generous to the people I call the compulsory pregnancy movement or the anti-choice, or maybe without being that unkind, at least the anti-abortion movement. Because when you allow them to self-define as
right,
the pro-life, They certainly, at least appearance-wise, have a sort of ethical leg up on people that want to take away, what do they say, a beating heart or whatever. Do you feel comfortable with designating them as the pro-life, which sort of means that people, those of us who believe in a woman's right to choose, kind of like say, what are we, anti-life?
Well, you know, you make a very important point. But the reason why I choose to call them pro-life is because that's what the American public knows them as.
Right.
Okay? I don't want to call them by another name that they're not recognized by and also reveal all of the sinister things they're up to. I want to call them by the name they're known and let the American public be the judge of whether or not they think these acts and these campaigns are reasonable. You know, but the truth is, I mean, I agree. I think, you know, looking at their tactics, you know, most of what they're saying to the American public is not scientific truth. In fact, it's often lies. I mean, I really feel like they're closer to a pro-lie movement when I looked and I've investigated most of their campaigns. But my point was being, you know, look, they didn't change the name Love Canal after they found out that it was a toxic wasteland. But people associated that name eventually with what it really was, and I hope by revealing what the Right to Life movement is up to, that Americans will see that, you know, if they truly want to reduce abortion rates, they'll look at the facts and discover that the pro-choice movement has always presided over the lowest abortion rates in the world. This is interesting that most Americans don't know this, but wherever in the world we go that has the lowest abortion rates, you see the strongest pro-choice policies. And wherever in the world you go and find the highest abortion rates, you have the strongest pro-life policies. And this trend is even true in our country. We witnessed the most dramatic decline in abortion rates in the recorded history of our country under our first pro-choice president, Bill Clinton. And the reason why is because these pro-choice politicians put into place prevention policies like access to contraception and sex education curriculum that actually has been proven to reduce teen sexual initiation and teen pregnancy and STDs rather than, you know, investing unforgivable sums of money into programs that we know don't work.
Mm-hmm.
What I'm trying to say is, you know, look, the American public, there's a lot of people who are on the fence about abortion, and I think that if you want to see fewer abortions, the only place to, you know, rest your cap is with the pro-choice movement.
Well, Christina Page, you mentioned Bill Clinton as the first pro-choice president and how abortion rate actually went down. I think if you ask the audience, and until I read your Baltimore Sun op-ed piece, The Quiet Campaign Against Birth Control, I don't know if I'd be able to answer this either. What is the record of the current administration, the George W. Bush administration, in terms of not abortion, but in terms of birth control?
Well, you know, when I tried to explain in this piece, and by the way, as it relates to abortion, what we see is this dramatic decline in abortion rates slowing under Bush, and in fact, the poorest people in our country are experiencing, no dips in abortion rates. So, what we're seeing is the trend repeat itself. They're presiding over higher abortion rates than pro-choice politicians would. But what Bush has done for his anti-contraception base is deliver a lot of successes over the last, 8 years, 7 years. He has done more to appease the anti-contraception folks than he has to appease those who are simply want to outlaw abortion. And so what we see, you know, with abortion is, you know, yes, he got Roberts. Yes, he got Alito. Yes, he signed in the first ban on a safe abortion procedure. But when it comes to attacks on contraception, he attempted to strip all federal employees of contraception benefits. He's defunded international contraception programs. He's appointed anti-contraception fanatics to oversee the contraception program for the poor, as well as appoint them to the FDA panel that approves new contraception. I mean, these are people who don't want contraception available, who are overseeing these programs. you know, this is it goes on and on, the list of anti-contraception acts. And the reason why he's been able to deliver on that so consistently is that the American public is probably unwilling to believe something so wacky.
Mm-hmm.
But as a result of, you know, who's against birth control? Well, you know, there's a growing movement, and they're increasingly more successful. And until the American public realizes that, you know, Roe v. Wade is not what they're after. They're after Griswold. And, you know.
Remind us about that. I couldn't remember the name of the case. I was going to bring that up.
Yeah, Griswold v. Connecticut is what Roe v. Wade was based on. And it really was the foundation argument on the right to privacy, and that, you know, the government could not intrude in personal matters such as, you know, whether and when to a woman would become pregnant. And so that started with Griswold, which allowed married couples the right to use contraception. And this is a very young law. I mean, it's only, it was 1965, so only 42 years old.
This is amazing. Forbid state. Right, from denying couples the right for availability. Was it through the mails or just in general?
Just in general,
yeah.
That married couples, and by the way, it was single people. By, you know, the Supreme Court didn't rule that single people could use contraception until 1972, which was a year before Roe v. Wade. And so, if we think that this is a law that's old and has, you know, weathered through the years, you know. It probably will be unraveled as quickly and as it was built, because if you overturn Roe v. Wade, you overturn the logic behind Griswold. You can't, you know, strike at the root of the tree and expect it to stand. And that's why Griswold is in as much of jeopardy with attacks on Roe as abortion rights.
Wow. Well, my guest is Christina Page on The Peter Werbe Show. She is the author of How the Pro-Choice Movement Saved America, Freedom, Politics, and the War on Sex. And I still want to get to some of that. The website to go to is birthcontrolwatch.org. I knew next to none of this. So this is extraordinary information. And it's at a stealth level because, as you say, Christina, at the end of your Baltimore Sun article, The Quiet Campaign Against Birth Control, considering that even 80% of self-described pro-life voters and a majority Republican voters strongly support contraception. And then you make another point. But so this is extraordinary. This isn't
right.
Even their base.
It's,
I mean,
well, it is their base. It's their primary base. This is what you call dog whistle politics. They are sending a message that only their base can hear. And so when Mitt Romney says, I worked to define life as beginning at conception rather than at the time of implantation, what that code means to his base is that, you know, I, like you, hope to reclassify the most commonly used forms of contraception as abortion. And I'd like to have life begin at an unknowable moment and women be held accountable by law for anything that happens to a fertilized egg, as it makes its stage towards implantation.
Mm-hmm. Now, much of what the anti-choice movement, I'm going to call them that.
Sure.
Let's call it the anti-abortion. The anti-abortion movement it's limited in terms of its medical pronouncements, but legally as well. Now, when they talk about an unborn baby, that has no basis in law whatsoever. I mean, life begins in terms of the way it's conceived of, currently conceived of, as when the baby exits the womb and can live on its own. I mean, a fetus can't be named. I mean, it can, but not legally. Can't inherit property. You know, all this kind of stuff. So, but on the other hand, anyone and any group has the right to attempt to redefine anything socially and politically, I don't know, biologically, but socially and politically. We've done that throughout history, including things that I'm sure that you and others are very sensitive to, like the women's right to vote. I mean, that had to be struggled for. So we have people here that are trying to redefine what a fetus is, when life begins and all that.
Right.
So in a way, you could say, so what? I mean,
yeah.
Let them do it. How's that going to affect you or me?
Well, you're exactly right. And what they're trying to do is build an architecture for their beliefs in law quietly. And so exactly as you've said, you know, they are giving health insurance benefits to unborn children. Now, this would be a woman could fall down a flight of stairs and break her leg and doesn't have coverage and will not be treated, but her unborn child would have the right to have medical care because that's what the federal government now has done. The, you know, quote-unquote Unborn Victims of Violence Act would give personhood to a fertilized egg.
Yeah, and,
And this is what it says in law. And so these are the building blocks of a completely new reality for Americans. I mean, I have in my last chapter of my book, which is, you know, how they're trying to define a fertilized egg as a full human being with full rights. And they've done this in a surprisingly high number of states. I think I'm just trying to see. It looks like I think 19 states identify a fertilized egg or conception as you know, a full human being.
The point being, and I think you've made it very strongly, is it's one thing to have an opinion. It's one thing to decide that that you don't want to use birth control, that you don't want to have an abortion, and don't. That's an individual, private decision, or one you may have with members of your family as a woman or with your physician. But when it's attempted to be put into law. And then that affects you and me, even though we don't agree their version of theology or biology.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Let me ask you about your book, because we might be getting down to the nub of this, because this I always wonder, what's this all about? I mean, but your book, Christina Page, is How the Pro-Choice Movement Saved America, Freedom, Politics, and the War on Sex, because if there's no birth control available... then you can make the point that the only way to you can have sex when you want to procreate, or and also if you want to, when you're dating, if you want to stay away from the dangers of STD, you don't have sex. So that seems to me to be an agenda that I've heard before.
That's right. I mean, this isn't about abortion. If it were about abortion, then what we would have is Right to Life groups sending their staffers over to the Netherlands as quickly as possible with pen and pad to figure out how it is that they have made abortion in their country the rarest on earth. And what they would find is the strongest pro-choice policies and education, actual sex education, which is scientifically based and age appropriate. But that's not the point. And instead what we see, exactly as you've said, is an attempt to really change the American way of life, because the 95% of Americans are having sex before they marry. And all the surveys say that, you know, on average, the average American is having sex once a week. We're not doing it with that frequency to have babies. This is a part of our lifestyle, and what I think the pro-choice movement has done is kept a wave of religious fundamentalism from washing over the American way of life. You know, we have Randall Terry, who's really an honored veteran a ranking leader in the Right to Life movement, and he says, you know, if you're using any type of birth control, stop. Leave the number of children you have in God's hands. Another leader, Joseph Scheidler, says, he thinks contraception is disgusting.
Well,
these are direct quotes.
Well, you know, I've actually read statistics. I'm not sure how they came up with this, but I remember having this on a talk show, saying that conservatives and right-wingers are reproducing at a faster rate than people on the left. So I don't know. I mean, we have now, and it usually is impolite to identify people by religion, but we essentially have a Catholic Supreme Court, and most Catholics, contrary to their church's teaching, utilize birth control. Yet you have five men who not only are Catholic, but they're also conservative Catholics.
Right.
So this does not bode
far
well.
Out of step, far out of step with what Americans, you know, belief system. But I also, I mean, what I like, I know what I continue to hope to do and prove in my book was that, you know, people of both sides should, you know, understand that we know what works. You know, I mean, you can be opposed to abortion, but banning it has never had an impact on its rates. In fact, the countries with the highest rates of abortion, sometimes twice as high as the American rate, are the ones who've outlawed abortion. And so if you're really, truly serious about making abortion less necessary and reducing the numbers, why don't we actually look at where those, you know, results have been found? And, you know, then the argument really gets started. I mean, I find when I'm in debates with those who claim to be opposed to abortion, and when we can say, okay, let's agree, let's just for the sake of argument say abortion is bad. Let's start there and let's both get on the same page of how to stop it, how to prevent it. Then their argument is over, because the only discussion that they can have is to browbeat and be sanctimonious about, you know, the fetus. You know, one other point, I think that this is, goes along with that, is that we've heard a lot about late-term abortion in the past decade. It's been really a soliloquy of the right-to-life movement, but no one has really gotten into the numbers and said, well, why is it that women are going to seek these services later in pregnancy? And when you do look at those figures, what you find is that 50% of women who are getting abortion procedures after 16 weeks cite pro-life restrictions as the cause.
Hmm.
You know, when Mississippi put a mandatory delay law on the books, the next year their second trimester abortion rate increased by 53%. And the same is true in Texas, where they saw a spike in 18-year-olds getting second trimester abortions after they put a parental consent law on the books. So, you know, if the gestational age matters, at which point, I mean, morally, and I would be one of the people who say it does, then the legalization of abortion was one of the most important things that had ever happened. It had brought the opportunity to make this decision as early as possible. And so we really need to start having, a much more fact-based discussion here and a less emotional one, because the American public is reasonable and wants to see these things, real results. And I think that if we can kind of clear the airwaves of all the, the volume, what we'll find is a little bit more startling than people originally thought.
Yeah, in terms of the anti-abortion rhetoric, I mean, I had one time on a phone-in talk show I was doing, someone said, abortion is murder. And I said, you think my wife is a murderer? And he said, well, because I said, well, you don't. And even historically, when abortion was illegal, abortion was punishable, but no one ever accused either the doctor or the woman, the mother, of murder.
Right. And, you know, I was, anti-abortion activist confronted me at one of my talks, and what she said was, you know, I've had two miscarriages, and I've asked my physician to show me the remains. And I'll tell you, I think, you know, at 8 weeks and at 12 weeks that was a human being.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, well, okay, you know, I think we've retraced this ground a lot. Let me pose a question to you. How would you like to be considered for double homicide? Because the way the laws that you're writing says that anything that you've done that created a hostile environment for those unborn children, you should be held culpable for. Now, that's really what they have in store, and she, you know, that put it on a little bit of a different, table, that discussion. But that's exactly what we're seeing, and that's exactly as these laws are written. You cannot distinguish a woman who is involuntarily miscarrying from a woman who has voluntarily and in a clandestine manner tried to self-induce an abortion.
Christina Page, we're almost out of time, and I brought this up and didn't finish it, didn't give you a chance to finish it well enough. At the end of your subtitle of your book is The War on Sex. Do you think that's what it's all about?
I do. I think that we have, instead of a movement that really is being intellectually honest, what we have is a really fundamentalist movement that is misleading the public, and their goal is to change the American average American's lifestyle.
Well, in what matter? We say war on sex. I mean, in other words, they want sex only for procreation, and this is sort of the fundamentalist. And
they want as many. I mean, they want unintended pregnancies to result. They want, you know, the average family to be, you know, have children they can't support. I mean, they don't want them. They believe that, you know, God will find a way. I mean, you know, you can tell Katrina victims that, you know, till you know you're blue in the face. But I think that, you know, what the religious fundamentalist groups believe is that, you know, every act of sex should have procreation in mind, and every fertilized egg should be brought to full term.
Well, that's why I call them the compulsory pregnancy movement. But Christina Page, I want to thank you so much for being with me. Christina is the author of How the Pro-Choice Movement Saved America: Freedom, Politics, and the War on Sex. She's a spokeswoman for birthcontrol.org. You can, and the, is the book listed there as well?
Yes, it is birthcontrolwatch.org.
Oh, did I leave out the word? Okay, birthcontrolwatch.org. Watch.org. I'll have a link on my site, Peter Werbe, WERBE.com as well. Christina Page, thanks for being on the program.
Thank you, Peter.
You're listening to WRIF.com.
Prank Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. It's a pleasure to be with you. If I simply introduced our guest, you'd probably say, yes, he's been on the Peter Werby Show many times before. I know Norman Solomon. He's a nationally syndicated columnist. He's the author of the book, War Made Easy, How Presidents and Pundits Keep Spinning Us to Death. With Reese Ehrlich, he wrote Target Iraq, What the News Media Didn't Tell You. There's a film, a documentary made from that. And I believe it's the book and the film is what we last talked with Norman Solomon about. But he is also the executive director of the Institute for Public Accuracy, from which many guests on the Peter Werby Show appear. He's the recipient of the George Orwell Award, which honors distinguished contributions to honesty and clarity in public language. And don't we need that? Norman Solomon, we reach him in San Francisco. Thanks, as usual, for being on the program.
Hey, thank you, Peter.
And you have a brand new book, Made Love, Got War. I love it. The play on that old phrase, Make Love, Not War. And subtitles, Close Encounters with America's Warfare State. The foreword's by Daniel Ellsberg. Daniel Ellsberg of Pentagon Papers fame. Well, I don't know, are you too young to do a memoir yet? I love it that you did it.
Well, I actually avoided calling it a memoir, although some people are putting it, you know, in that category. I think of it as a sort of a semi-kind of sort of memoir, maybe partly because at age 56, I feel like, hey, I'm way too young to even think about doing that. But it does kind of, to what extent it includes my personal sort of memories and eyewitness accounts, it's really in the context of the social, cultural, political events of the last half century rather than the other way around. So, you know, my wife will tell you that I do have an appreciable ego, but it's small enough to realize my life really isn't all that important, but it is sort of my window into the events that have been important affecting our country and the world.
Well, you talk about in Made Love, Got War that you came under FBI surveillance at age 14. What in the hell were you doing back then to have the FBI on your tail?
Well, J. Edgar Hoover's boys, and they were almost all boys back then, had a lot better things to do than watch me at a demonstration for the integration of an apartment building in suburban Washington in the Maryland suburbs. But evidently they had some time on their hands, and as the saying goes, devil's playmate, you know. This was 1965, and I didn't learn about this till many years later when I filed the Freedom of Information Act request and got this back, and a lot of it was blacked out, so I can't tell you exactly why they were gathering a file on me, but the 25 words that were remaining on the page made clear they had their eye on me. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I really wish they had tracked organized crime as diligently as they did this 14-year-old kid.
Yeah, when Norman Solomon, our guest, says they were blacked out, what he means is these sections of when people received portions of their FBI file, it was what they call redacted, and it was literally blacked out. And sometimes it seemed extraordinarily arbitrary, and it could have been just some bored FBI clerk saying, you know, there's a section of that, I think, in, I can't think of the name of the book, Catch-22, where the censor just sort of randomly on a given day blocks out whatever they feel like it. But, you know, I wonder, Norman Solomon, when you say that you first came under FBI surveillance at age 14, there's two aspects to government surveillance. One, of course, is they want to keep an eye on who they consider dangerous radicals like you and me. But the other is to intimidate people. Now, it doesn't intimidate me, and it doesn't intimidate you because you have this decades-long history of social activism and for peace and social justice, but I can imagine someone listening to this broadcast and saying, wait a minute, they were looking, they were doing surveillance of a 14-year-old. Maybe I better just keep out of even going to the local demonstration that I was going to go to next Saturday here in Detroit.
Yeah, well, there is that effort, I think, to intimidate people, at least tacitly or implicitly. And I think it's important to just say, basically, to ourselves and each other, it's not going to work. There's too many of us who care about social justice, peace, racial, gender equality, gay rights, the environment, to stop global warming, to end the war in Iraq. There's just millions of Americans, and we have, if not safety in numbers, at least a lot of camaraderie and mutual support. So, hey, you know, it doesn't worry me, and I really hopefully think it won't worry most people.
Mm-hmm. Now, some of the words that you just used, civil liberty, civil rights, anti-war, I mean, sort of, you know, summarizing some of what you just said, figures into an award you received, and I mentioned that, the George Orwell Award from the National Council of Teachers of English, and you got honored for distinguished contributions to honesty and clarity in public language. Now, what the utterances you just made are, in many ways, loaded phrases. I don't mean in bad ways, but they're freighted. I guess that's the verb people use. So if you say peace, if you say gay rights, that conjures up any number of interpretations by the listeners. Tell us a little about George Orwell and the award and why there's an award named after him and what clarity in public language means to you.
Yeah, well, the phrasing of that award really is a window into what we have to contend with, because if they're singling out something that, as an organization, the Council of Teachers of English views as honesty, then there must be a big problem with dishonesty. If they're singling out clarity, then they must perceive a huge problem with lack of clarity, which is to say fogging, covering up, being disingenuous, outright lying. And certainly that was the case in terms of the lead-up to the Iraq War. That's why people, whether they live in Detroit or around the country, are liable to know folks, relatives, friends, acquaintances, schoolmates, co-workers, who, whether in the National Guard or otherwise, ended up in Iraq or Afghanistan, really based on a whole pattern of deception. So the words that are used in media by the spinmeisters, the pundits, the politicians, they have really human consequences, and I think that's the key point around language.
Now, one more thing about language. Let's take something that's heavily freighted with public concern, let's say, and that is gay rights. It could mean to a conservative or right-wing pundit, these are people that want special privileges within our society. To you and me and lots of other people, it means essentially broadening the concept of a democratic society to let everybody in and to not discriminate against people on the basis of sexual preference. But so, I mean, you know, what we used to ask we'd be sitting up in the dorms at Michigan State at 1 a.m. saying, yeah, what is reality? How can we associate, or how can we define a phrase in terms of what, clarity in public language in say, just in that little phrase?
Well, if we go back and we look through history, when women were fighting for the right to vote, there were claims that they were asking for special privileges. I know I'm old enough to remember the civil rights movement that came to the fore and had most impact noticeably during the 1960s. There was all kinds of complaining and accusations that black people wanted special privileges. We're hearing that a lot now about gay men and lesbians and when they are and others in solidarity saying, look, we all have a right to the same human rights under the law that includes civil union marriage, whatever you want to call it, the right to, as a human being, assert that no one else has more or less prerogatives under the law based on money, sexual orientation, race, gender, anything else. And so if people are used to inequity, they start to look at proposals to remedy the problem as special rights.
Mm-hmm. Now, let me reintroduce you. Norman Solomon is my guest on the Peter Werbe Show. His brand new book, which looks back on 40 years of activism in the social context in which Norman Solomon has lived his life, is called Made Love, Got War, Close Encounters with America's Warfare State. The foreword is by Daniel Ellsberg, the man that exposed the lies of the Vietnam War and the Pentagon Papers. Now, Norman Solomon, through your work with the Institute for Public Accuracy, you probably could have had 50 or 60 people would have gladly have written the introduction. Why did you select Daniel Ellsberg?
To me, he really epitomizes speaking truth to those who were trying to squelch it and to everybody else about the actions of the war makers. He took a tremendous risk, faced more than 100 years in prison sentencing by letting the public see the Pentagon Papers, these super classified documents that proved how the lies were told in the launching of the war in Vietnam. I almost said the war in Iraq. It was mm-hmm. very close to being a slip. But there is that distant mirror and the parallels today. And so he's been an activist ever since, and I think his voice is tremendously important today.
Mm-hmm. Tell us what we find in Made Love, Got War. And I love the twist on the old Make Love, Not War. So this is Made Love, Got War. What do we...
Well, it's really an account of memory, of experience, of the ways in which history and the social events of the time are intertwined with our lives. You know, there is the saying, the personal is political, and maybe it's too easy to say that, but when I go back and I think of living through five decades, so many aspects of my own life and the lives and sometimes deaths of people I've known have been totally intertwined with power, privilege, wars, the leverage over people's health care, education, housing, environment. So I try to look back and not compartmentalize whether it's sex, drugs, rock and roll, or war. These are all strands of, if you will, the rope that pulls us along or that guides us along. And to separate it out is really an artificial invention, often from media and politics.
Mm-hmm. Now, we have had you, and I say we because my old on-air partner, when we worked with the IE America radio network, Jalene Jordan and I have interviewed you any number of times. And, I mean, it could be close to a dozen over the last 7 years or something like
sure.
that. So we just assume here's Norman Solomon. He's an associate of Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. He's the executive director of the Institute for Public Accuracy. You've written 12 books. And yet, you know, you've had, let me see, I'm trying to do the math, 49 years before that. How did you, I mean, what kind of choices did you make in life? Were you on like a track? Like one point I was on a track to be a lawyer. Glad I got out of that. What was your early experience in terms of goals, and how did you get into being a full-time media activist?
I certainly didn't plan it. You know, I was in high school. I did plan to go to college, be a professional. I thought maybe I would be a lawyer. Yeah, or something very professional, hopefully fairly high paying, etc. Certainly respectable. My goodness, I was going to be respectable. That was assumed, you know, growing up middle class in the suburbs. And gradually that just sounded more and more boring and distasteful. The Vietnam War, when I began to see it as just a horrific war based on lies. How could people in charge of our government who claim to be looking after our well-being inflict that on U.S. citizens and those living in Southeast Asia? And so really, if there were, you know, if there was a little license plate that I was going to choose, a little motto, it would be something like one thing led to another. Mm-hmm. And that's really been it.
Well, in the book, Jack, and I haven't even given the publisher. It's Polypoint Press, and you can go to P3Books.com. And I should have asked you before, you have your own website, am I correct?
Yeah, it's MadeLoveGotWar.com.
Oh, okay. That's an easy one. Well, there's a nice mainstream photograph of you. You even have a tie on, a nice blue shirt. At some time, did you have real long hair and a big beard?
Oh, you know, never a beard, but I had my hair got very straggly. I had not gotten a haircut for many months at a time in the late 60s and early 70s. And I think if I lived in a cold weather climate, probably wintertime, the hair would grow longer. But also, you know, styles do change, and I guess I'm susceptible to that as well.
Yeah. And also, it's just not the book just doesn't cover your early history, but some of the controversial trips you made to Iraq and Iran. And you've recounted those before. Is there and I remember you have I think maybe when you came back, that was it. I don't think the accounts have not appeared in previous books, have they?
Not all of the information. I mean, there's some narrative in previous books, but I really tried to talk more personally about how it felt. I mean, there's a passage in this new book that I never talked to anybody before about or written about, where I'm in a hotel in Baghdad, the Al-Rashid. It's December 2002. A war is clearly coming. I'm walking through the lobby day in and day out, and I keep hearing the Moody Blues album as Muzak, kind of a washed out Knights in White Satin. And I was very tired, and it got very surrealistic. I thought I had like gone down the rabbit hole with Alice in Wonderland.
What was the circumstances? I think we talked, in fact, I'm positive we did. We talked to you when you came back from Iraq. But remind us of your trip and who you accompanied and the purpose of it.
Well, I went to Baghdad three times in the half a year before the invasion. The first time was with a congressman, Nick Rahal, from West Virginia. We were setting up meetings with Iraqi officials to try to break the ice and the stalemate and the threats coming between Washington and Baghdad. This was kind of private citizen diplomacy. And then in December 2002, I accompanied Sean Penn and helped to organize his trip to Baghdad, which I think was, on his part, a very courageous thing to do, to go there. He knew he'd get brickbats from Fox News and the Murdoch acolytes and all the rest of it. And then I went back in January 2003, and it was frightening to see how easy it was in the United States to make objects out of real human beings in Baghdad. And you see them in person, you think, I don't want my country to bomb these children.
Well, this country did under George W. Bush under false pretenses. Of course, we were never threatened with weapons of mass destruction. Saddam Hussein had an army of dust and never threatened any of his neighbors, and there was no connection with 9/11. I remember when I saw, is it March 17th? Is that the date of the war or somewhere right around in there?
Right there. I think that was the time of one of his last speeches, Bush's prevaricating speeches from the White House before the invasion.
Yeah. And the shock and awe that we saw on Baghdad, and it was sort of like fireworks that they have every year on the Detroit River to someone like us. It was just big explosions and pretty colorful, actually. You were there. You were in the city. As you said, you didn't want the children of that city, or I'm sure the adults, bombed. What was your personal reaction when you saw this?
Well, I was back in the U.S. Seeing it on TV, and there would be a shot of the Tigris River, and I would think of being along the banks of that river at an evening, and I write about this in the book, watching the sweethearts talking across the candles, and to imagine what was happening then, and really is now still today in a somewhat different form. It's horrific. It's very upsetting, and it takes away the abstraction of war. It's as though our neighbors were being bombed, and they are, you know, not to get kind of syrupy about it, but they are our brothers and sisters when you get right down to it. So for our government and our names with our tax dollars based on lies to inflict this horror on people, it's very upsetting, and I think a call to action to oppose these policies.
Well, Norman Solomon, maybe someone's listening and thinking, wait a minute now, you're going to Iraq, you've been to Iran. Seems like you have more sympathy for these governments run by these distasteful personalities and theologies than you do for our government.
Well, you know, I've always said that Saddam Hussein was a terrible dictator, and I said it at the time, including when I was in Baghdad doing interviews with the likes of the BBC. I was in Tehran 2 years ago, and that government is run by fanatical fundamentalists, as is the U.S. government in terms of the people running the White House.
Yeah.
So there we have it, the axis of fanatics.
Yeah, yeah. But the people are a different thing. Of course, the people of Iraq that have suffered so horrendously, the lowest now respectable figure for civilian casualties, the absolute lowest is 300,000, and repeatedly now the figure of 1 million by different other respectable studies is being shown. 4 million internal and external refugees, and this is all for people that had no control over their own fate at all. In other words, it wasn't like they were big supporters of Saddam Hussein, right?
Yeah. That's right.
Maybe some part of it, or part of them. Made Love, Got War is the name of Norman Solomon's latest book. The subtitle is Close Encounters with America's Warfare State. Conservatives talk a lot about welfare state. What's a warfare state? Hello.
Well,
but maybe you could spell it out some.
Well, we're in one that's now entering its seventh year of warfare in Afghanistan. $2 billion a day. I find that a staggering figure. $2 billion a day of taxpayer money going into the military, which is distinct from defense. If it was a real defense budget, authentically defense, it would be so much smaller. And that's a tip-off to the warfare state. The enormous profits, the militarization, the mentality. I watch TV and I see all these ads for the Air Force and the Marines making it look glamorous. This is bad news when our roads, bridges, schools, health clinics, hospitals are falling apart, sometimes literally, and we've got money to spend to incinerate people with these weapons. I just find that absolutely unacceptable.
Well, Norman Solomon, you may know, like a number of other states, Michigan is deeply in debt and required by our state constitution to have a balanced budget. So there has to be more funds raised or more programs cut. And right now, the state legislature is talking about raising the income tax, which is a flat tax and a regressive tax, and also raising the sales tax from 4% to 6%. And this, of course, will hit the poorest the hardest. And yet we have a combined total of the two Bush wars, $12 billion a month. A couple of days of the Iraq War, and George could just write a check, and Michigan's budget crunch would be solved.
No doubt. It was back in 1967, Martin Luther King Jr. said something that is just as true today. He said, a country that year after year is spending more on military defense than on social uplift is approaching spiritual death, and we are suffering with the consequences of that reality every day in this country.
Norman Solomon, you're such an extraordinarily sharp observer of contemporary politics, and I always want to get your opinions on that. That's why I've interviewed you so many times. But your book, Made Love, Got War, goes back a few years in your life. And we only have a few minutes left, and I want to spend a little time back in the past, back in the day, as they say, currently. And when you look back over what you've lived of your life, what are the standouts? What are the things, if someone said, what have you done that you're the most proud of, or to be at an event that was a signal and something that's recounted in your book?
Well, more generally, it's a lot of feeling of working with other people, being honest and sharing and caring, and that it coming from a sense of connection. That's been real powerful. I think one of the specific things for me, actually, was when I was involved in the nonviolent civil disobedience effort to blockade nuclear warhead trains. These were so-called white trains that were carrying warheads with nuclear weapons to the Trident nuclear subbase in the 1980s through the Pacific Northwest. And in a sort of Gandhian way, with dozens of other people sitting on the tracks in front of the trains, I felt it was a very important sort of a step to take. And we stopped the trains for at least a couple of hours. So that was something.
Any regrets about what you said earlier, that you didn't go on to a so-called respectable life? I think you have a very, very extraordinarily respectable life, but I guess mainstream is. And Gaia loved the people that have made those choices, as long as they also realize what's happening in our country and are participating in it to the largest extent they can.
Sure. Well, I think every life path is and should be different, and the straightest distance between two points, contrary to geometry, is not a straight line. I mean, the most effective or meaningful distance. And so I think in so many lives, and including my own, it's ourselves. We're the ones who will know and discover what makes sense. And somebody else saying, jump into this lockstep and that one, that's just not going to cut it.
Now, we just have a minute or so left, but when we spoke about your trip to Iran, even back then that George Bush was making warlike noises towards that country, and there's so much one hears in the press. I mean, Iran is certainly demonized there. What are they? They're accused of meddling in Iraq. Do you think there's going to be war with Iran?
Well, I think it's quite likely. I'm not optimistic and I'm not fatalistic. The absurdity, the Orwellianisms of, yes, we're told Iran is so bad because they're actually allowing bombs to go into Iraq. I mean, this is so crazy coming from the U.S. And because the level of hypocrisy is so extreme and accepted so much, the danger is great. The Bush people might want to and might be able to attack Iran politically, especially if we make it easy for them by being passive. So I'm all for opposing that before it happens.
Mm-hmm. Well, here's one of the endorsements on the back of your book, Made Love, Got War, from Phil Donahue. Here's a book with 1,000 memories for those of us who came of political age while living through urban riots, the Vietnam War, and the Nixon years. Norman Solomon, one of America's most respected progressive voices, gets personal in this account of living through the age of Nixon, tie-dye T-shirts, girlfriends, and even the music that will forever waft through the minds of those of us who were there. It's a wonderful endorsement along with quite a few others. The book is Made Love, Got War, Close Encounters with America's Warfare State. Norman Solomon has been my guest on the Peter Werbe Show. This set of memories has a foreword by Daniel Ellsberg. You can go to Made Love, Not War. MadeLoveGotWar.com. I'll have a link on my site. Peter Werbe, do that for me, Norman. Peter Werbe, WERBE.com. When I can't even spell my own last name, I think it's time to say, Norman Solomon, thanks for being on the Peter Werbe Show.
Hey, thank you, Peter.
Weekday night to 10 with Meltdown. It's like getting hit in the head by a 2x4 with a nail in it. Mandatory Metallica. Now, it's your triple play of the mighty Metallica with a big unit every weekday night at 10, exclusively from your one and only Metallica station, 101 WRIF. Everything that rocks.
You're listening to WRIF.com.
Yeah.
wouldn't it be grand to get around and have a listen?
Well, turn something on. I'm starting to think.
A date which will live.